Hello? Committee, where are you? Senator Winters, Senator Walker, I know the two of you are here already. Committee on Human Services. Are we ready, Pat? Senate Committee on Human Services Agency Oversight, and today is February the 28th, 2006. Thank you very much. Want to officially welcome Senator Walker to the committee. And it's very nice to have you here. Very hard worker. Be prepared for a lot of questions. She is very thorough in her research. And we like that about her. And Senator Winters is back from the great state of Texas, where she was a panel on a program that was aired across the nation on CNN called The Black Covenant with America. So I'm glad you got back safely, Senator Winters, and hope you had a nice time there.
I did. I'm probably still a little bit in
jet lag.
I have to say it was pretty heady company.
I saw the people that you were among, Senator, so I know you were in heady
company. On the national panel, people that you hear about in the news, and you don't, I think, in terms of Oregon being on that.
That's great.
That panel.
It was great to hear that. I'd like to also say I just got a call from Senator Westland, who said it was by some hook or crook off of his radar screen, and so he has a speaking engagement in his district and could not come. Senator Devlin is going to be about 9:30 getting here. He has a meeting in his district that he's already at as well. But you have the three of us who are very attentive to what you're going to be saying today, because we take very serious the task that we have before us in terms of the direction in which we're going as a state and the responsibilities that we have as a result of this agency, also the commitment that we have to the people of Oregon in serving the citizens of the state. So this is a very serious committee endeavor, and we want to work as partners with you, but work as partners with citizens of the state in carrying out the leanest, meanest budget that we can in terms of what we do in human services, but at the same time make sure that all Oregonians who fall under the aegis of this agency are cared for with dignity and with pride and with the kind of service that they should expect with a smile. So that's what our goal is here, and I'm looking forward to that goal being fulfilled. Also note that Dr. Goldberg, who really, really regrets that he was not able to be here, and Clyde will probably say a little more about that, was at a governor's meeting among governors across the country with President Bush on yesterday. So we know that his spirit is with us, and we would like for him to have been here, but under the circumstances, we'd rather for him to be where he was, and that is so that the president will have a message in terms of the kind of struggles that we're having with human services, not just here in Oregon, but across America. But it's more highlighted in Oregon because we're way here in the Pacific Northwest, and we have not kept up with the nation in terms of jobs. And so we're at about a 5.4 now, and the nation is at about 4.7, mm-hmm. and which means that we still have a little more work to do than other states have to do in terms of the kind of things that we do in the mission of this agency. So before we begin and introduce Clyde, would either Senator Winters or Senator Walker have something to say? Did I make you nervous, Senator?
I'm trying to be quiet back here.
I received also a note from a constituent of Senator Devlin saying, Senator Carter, I listen to your committee faithfully and enjoyed the comments from the Department of Oversight that you guys are doing. But when a senator is speaking, would you please say their name so that I can know who's talking? So if I say Senator Winters, Senator, I'm not being so formal, but at the same time, people in media land don't know who's talking unless I refer to your name. So it will be sounding a little formal, but rather than just, okay, Senator, you know.
Well, I really have nothing more to add to your comments. This is a very important committee, and the work of this committee is extremely important. And I think often we forget this is the largest agency in a state government, the second largest budget. Which provides services to the major population of the citizens of the state, and so the work that's being done is work that is very, very important. I think sometimes we don't put it in its context, and it's also an agency that is so multifaceted. It's not like clearly you're dealing with one issue. You're dealing with multiple issues that are human in nature. And so I can't reinforce more of the chair's comment of how important it is that the work that we do and that we take it. I know I take it very seriously because of its impact and implications for all of our communities around the state.
Thank you, Senator Winters. For that, because I know that your love and your passion for this has been over the years as well. The other thing is that we have a very packed program today. Mm-hmm. And Clyde, rather than for me to be coming to and fro, I'd like Mr. Psyche to be able to introduce each panel as they come along, because we could do that with our memory sheets up here, but I think if we would do that, it'll move the process faster.
I'd be happy to.
Mr. Clyde Psyche, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Carter and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. And I'd just like to start by saying that the department really appreciates the commitment and passion and concern and support that we've received from both yourself, Senator Winters, and Senator Walker over the years. We do appreciate your commitment to the services we provide and the people we provide services to, which, as you know, are probably some of the most vulnerable people in the state of Oregon. Director Goldberg did ask me to pass along his regrets for not being here this morning. He's at the National Governors Association Conference with Governor Kulongoski. They had the opportunity to meet with President Bush and to get more information about his proposed budget and the Budget Reduction Act. And as all of you know, certain parts of the act could have a profound effect on our budget and our ability to provide services, and so he felt it was very important that he be there for that discussion. We're here this morning to provide information to you on several different areas, and we have a number of different people who will be taking part in the presentation. With your permission, Chair Carter, I'd like to just give a quick overview of the presentation, and then if we need to make any changes or you have any additional information you want, we can take that into consideration as we move forward. The first issue we want to talk to you about is information management systems and technology. We'll give you a brief historical perspective and then talk about the current environment and the challenges and issues that we face. During the presentation, we'll also address resource issues and some of the issues that staff face in our current technological environment. As part of the presentation, we'll also have several staff and managers share their experiences and challenges in working in our current technological environment. We'll also be talking to you this morning about the caseload forecasting process. We'll give you a brief overview of the process and then talk about policies, resource issues, and other factors that influence that process. So if that agenda meets with your approval, Chair Carter, I would like to call our first two presenters to the table, Firborz Praksaraj, who is our Chief Administrative Officer, and Bill Crowell, who is our Chief Information Officer. Firborz and Bill will be giving the committee an overview of our Office of Information Services. They'll be talking about the current environment and the resource and technological issues we face. They'll also be telling the committee or sharing with the committee strategies that we're employing to deal with these issues and the vision for the future of information technology in DHS. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Firborz, who will start the presentation.
Good morning, Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Firborz Praksaraj, and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for Department of Human Services. With me today is our Chief Information Officer, Bill Crowell. Will be sharing this presentation. What I will be covering is the history of information technology in the department up to the present time, and Bill will take us into the future and how we will be dealing with the challenges that we face. Just to give you some background about how the Office of Information Services was created, in 1996 we created OIS, Office of Information Services, and centralized IT services and operations into a single organization within DHS. Before 1996, what we had was in the seven separate divisions that we had, each of those divisions had IT services within them. They had all dedicated IT staff. They all had their chief information officers. And this created a siloed approach that resulted in duplicate efforts and non-standard technologies, systems that were independent of one another and did not necessarily communicate with one another. After 1996, what happened was that all of these functions were consolidated into Office of Information Services, decentralized the staff into this newly created office, and from that point on, IT units were based on functional duties to take advantage of the skills that the staff and management had. One of the points that I want to make early on is that although we did consolidate the staff, consolidating systems is a much more formidable task. And, you know, as we go through the presentation, we hope to be able to highlight that point. Historically, the department has primarily focused on funding for business programs and client support. and technology infrastructure to support administrative functions such as finance, forecasting, analysis, security, or personnel has historically been secondary. This next slide highlights the 10 largest and most complex systems that we have in DHS. And as you can see, there are quite a few of these systems that are fairly old. And I just want to spend a short amount of time just talking about three of these systems and the impact that they have to Oregonians and to the economy.
Let me ask you one question. Would you rather for members of the committee to ask you questions at the close of each of your subject areas, or would you encourage it as you go along? I don't want to break your train of thought.
Chair Carter, we would really entertain questions at any point in the presentation.
Okay.
And that will be just fine.
Okay, so in 1996, when you made the change in terms of staffing patterns, of being able to look at a complete and thorough IT system, why did not the systems change to be able to accommodate who was doing what in whatever department? Because obviously it affected your financial ability to be able to do any forecasting that would make sense in terms of keeping the budget balanced. And if you don't want to answer that right now, you can just keep it in the back of your mind until you get to a point where you're going to be discussing that.
Chair Carter, we will cover that in the coming slides. As I just mentioned, consolidating systems is a very difficult task. Most of these systems that you can see on the screen right now are legacy systems. They're basically first generation technology,
okay,
mainframe technology. Although they are large systems, they have a lot of capabilities, they cannot communicate with one another, and that creates significant challenges, some of which we will cover in the coming slides.
Thanks.
So the first system that you see on the list, the Food Stamp Management Information System, processes about 200,000 payments per month and serves about 366,000 clients. The system, as you can see, was put into place in 1979. It's quite old. The next system that I just want to briefly talk about is MMIS, the Medicaid Management Information System, which is our largest IT system, in fact, the largest IT system in state government. And this system originally was designed to process about 260,000 payments per month. Currently, it's processing 1.7 million, to the tune of about $200 million per month. It serves 400,000 clients, about 20,000 healthcare providers. And it's written, again, in first-generation technology in COBOL, and it contains 1.5 million lines of code. The newest technology system that we have, which is the last one, the Women, Infant, and Children Information System, was built just a few years back. This is, of course, you know, in newer technology. It makes 265,000 payments per month and serves about 103,000 clients. Now, these 10 systems by no means are the only systems that we have in DHS. All in all, we have about 250 systems, written in 22 different languages, 9 different databases, and 5 separate platforms. And therein lies part of our challenge, because we have such a diverse environment. So what we want to share with you in the next few slides are the challenges that we face, the primary technology issues and challenges that we face, and the way that we will go through these. We will highlight the challenges. What do those challenges, what are the impacts of those challenges to the department, and what are some of the mitigating efforts that we are putting in place in order to deal with those challenges? We've identified 4 areas to share with you this morning. Number one, you know, the biggest challenge that we have is that the technology that we have in OIS and DHS comes in too many flavors. You know, the systems were created in a siloed environment. These are legacy systems. Again, very powerful, but very difficult to interface with other new technology. And finally, the IT governance challenge that we face. And, you know, we'll explain all of those.
Madam Chair.
Question, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you. Could you explain to me what you mean by a legacy system?
A legacy system is basically large mainframe systems that are written, that are created in the first generation technology, basically mainframe. The second generation technology would be client server. And the newest technology would be the web environment, the web development, which is most of the applications that you see today is created in the newer technology.
So if I go back and remember this silly movie, the computer wore tennis shoes, where the computers were these giant, huge machines in this
right.
room, that's what we're talking about with legacy?
Not exactly. I mean,
far back?
Even within the legacy world, there are older systems and newer systems. So those are probably the older systems that you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, my husband works at the Register Guard, the newspaper in Eugene, and he works in information systems, and when he first started working there 20 plus years ago, they had things that I called, the kids called, our children called washing machines, giant machines, and they put a vac pack inside it and pulled it out. Now the machines are very, very small, so that's how far technology has come. So now I follow what you're talking about.
Thank you.
Can I just point out that these four issues are what I call the biggest challenge that we have in this state in terms of the opportunity to deliver quality services. And please keep in mind my second question, and that would be, if we talk too many flavors, what other state in the nation that has a first-rate program where systems can interact with each other and bring about the kind of excellence in services as well as opportunity in being able to communicate to each other?
Chair Carter, I think that's a very good point, and I think as we get further into the presentation and we talk about some of the mitigation strategies that we're putting in place, we'll talk a little bit about what we're doing as far as identifying sort of best systems, best practices in other states, and how we can import that technology into Oregon.
Okay. And committee, one other thing is that in 99, 2000, even 98, back in 98, we were worried about the Y2K and how we were going to go into the next century being able to have better IT services, and the state has repeatedly not come up with the dollars that it takes. We piecemealed it all the way. We've not been able to come up with the dollars that it takes to put a first-class service in place. So I just wanted to put that on the record as well. Sorry, put that on the record.
Thank you. So let's begin with too many flavors. In DHS, we have too many different programming languages, databases, and tools to support and use, which results in increased cost of ownership to purchase, maintain, and support these systems. We also have a number and a variety of network servers and operating systems. These non-standard technologies create complexity in processes and procedures that, again, result in inefficiencies. Until most recently, we have been supporting 69 different desktop images and many non-standard desktop workstations, which has resulted in a slow response to desktop issues. Lack of standard images actually make problems more difficult to diagnose and resolve because of the variety of the machines that we had and the variety of the images that we had. What we are doing to deal with these challenges is that we have created a standards committee to set and review technology standards. We have implemented a plan to ensure that hardware remains current, and that we're able to support the changing business need and a changing environment in DHS. And within the past 2 years, we've managed to reduce the number of desktop images from 69 to 20. Again, this creates a stable environment where support can be easier, less costly, and more efficient. As far as, you know, systems that have been created in silos, one of our primary challenges in DHS has been lack of integrated data. Many client and provider databases exist independently and separately. As a result, time spent to access multiple systems to locate data causes lost productivity. We also have multiple and independent client and provider databases, making data exchange more difficult, creating duplicate data, and requiring duplicate data entry into and multiple databases.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winter.
If there is one central issue, as you probably would guess, it's one that this senator has talked about, and I think we've talked about as a state of how we're going to deliver services efficiently for 30 years. Because the basic principle, or part of the principles of creating the department, was with having integrated services and the ability to do those services without having duplication in some of those efforts. So it's one that I'm extremely interested in, and at some point that as a state we really must solve this problem. If we're ever going to be able to provide the array of services that citizens need in this state.
I hate to sound a little excited, but they call it money, 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 money.
money. That's true, and it's also one where, as you understand, we overcome this whole issue of confidentiality and and the whole team approach to delivering services. So there's two aspects to it.
Right, but let me ask a question, that's a good point. Are there things that you can do to create this requirement, this federal requirement for privacy, and at the same time have these multiple databases do something in terms of being able to talk with other departments without a stated amount of money?
Senator Carter, I think there are things we can do, and while confidentiality is very important and we take our responsibilities in that area very seriously, I think oftentimes we err on the side of caution in probably do not share information as readily as we're allowed to. And so I think there are some things we can do on policy and the process side to help facilitate what Senator Winters is talking about, and those are things we're working on. On the system side, it just becomes a little more difficult, and I think your comment was very apropos, because as a department, we typically have made a decision, instead of making investments in infrastructure and technology, we've decided not to invest money there in times of budget reductions and really invest money on the client services side, which is appropriate, and I think it's the right thing to do. However, at some point in time, that catches up with you, and I think we're at a place where it's catching up with us now.
Rick, I'm sorry, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Fire or Fair Boards, at some point, could you also, if you can, quantify dollar-wise what it takes maybe to maintain an antiquated system versus any cost savings you might see with a state-of-the-art, both in terms, I guess, maintenance, even resource time, people time to do that? I mean, later during your presentation.
Yeah, Mr. Bricobian, I think Mr. Crowell in his testimony might be able to give you some idea, and if that's not to the level the committee wants, we can certainly get back to you with a more detailed analysis of that.
The last point in this slide is that we've been using single point solutions to address specific needs, really not taking into consideration global need of the department. And that naturally causes inconsistent data between systems and uncertainty in determining accuracy and completeness of information. So what we're doing to mitigate some of these challenges that we just described is that we're extracting and summarizing data from multiple client systems for analysis and forecasting purposes. And we have implemented an IT governance and business case process to ensure a more global and holistic approach to existing and future IT investments. Earlier we talked about legacy systems. In DHS, we have a large number of aging legacy systems that are inflexible and difficult to support and enhance. These systems require a large percentage of resources focused on outdated technology, and the time spent maintaining these legacy systems increases the backlog of customer requests, not only as it relates to these systems, but any other technology requests that we might have within the department. There is a huge challenge in maintaining older DHS technology. They're difficult to leverage new technology to work with these legacy systems. These systems don't communicate with the new systems. Also, you know, one of the other points that I wanted to mention is that the challenge of legacy systems and these old mainframe systems is not really unique to DHS. This is a statewide phenomenon. Even DAS systems suffer from the same problems that we face as far as legacy systems in DHS. And that limits any department's ability to be flexible in resource allocation and growth and data sharing. So what we're doing on that front, I think all of you know that we are in the process of creating a new MMIS, Medicaid Management Information System, that is scheduled to go online in mid to late 2007. We are also updating and renovating our Automated Child Welfare Information System, SACWIS. Also, what we've done within the department is that we have implemented a buy versus build strategy, trying to use software that's already been developed rather than building new software. Things such as commercial off-the-shelf software, government off-the-shelf software, open source. In some cases, those are virtually free, and transferring in systems from other states. The final issue that we want to cover as far as the challenges that we face is governance. A lack of consistent process for organizing, planning, and approving customer requests can result in IT investment decisions that lack coordination and holistic planning. Since IT investment decisions are not always evaluated with a department-wide view, greater outlay of resources is required to implement and support multiple point solutions. And finally, limited strategic planning throughout the department causes inability to leverage investments made in other areas of the department and makes it more difficult to align IT with business needs. And it also creates a potential for imbalance between return on investment and value that we can bring to the public. What we've done on the governance front to address some of these issues is we have created an IT governance council to provide centralized IT oversight. We have created information system management groups that work with each cluster and use a standard approach for requesting technology change. And we also have created a business case process where every business case is reviewed for to balance risk, return on investment, and value to the public. You know, given that we are not a private sector company, we can't always focus on dollars. Sometimes we face mandates, regulatory changes, so we have to balance those variables.
So are members of the business community a part of this?
Within DHS, the business community per se is not a part of this. How they may become a part of this is business community as vendors. For example, you know, in MMIS, almost all of those functions are contracted out to the business community out there to build the system, maintain the system.
Let's say Mr. Bruce Bishop says the state owes hospitals a certain amount of money, mm-hmm. and that the state has not been able to turn around the amount of dollars that they owe hospitals in, say, 60 to 90 day time frame. Mm-hmm. I don't think that he could have, he being the business community, could have a great appreciation for why you can't turn around any faster unless they have some knowledge about this, because some of the things you said today are very vital in terms of why your turnaround time is like it is in terms of responding to requests for investment that these particular companies have invested in our clients.
Right.
So, Clyde, how do you guys deal with that?
Well, Senator Carter, I think that's a good point. And I don't know if the committee recalls, but in our last meeting, Director Goldberg said that one of the things he's doing is establishing an advisory council of private sector members to talk about fiscal issues, payment issues, system issues. And I think that will go a long way in involving people in the private sector to do two things. Number one, to give them a better understanding of the very issue mm-hmm. you're talking about and some of the complexities and the challenges that we face. But number two, and I think even more importantly, it'll give us an opportunity to sort of pick their brain and to get counsel and advice from them and to talk about best practices in the private sector that right. we could then replicate within the department. So I think, to your point, we would see that advisory counseling group key to accomplishing some of the things you mentioned.
The last point that we want to make here is that we have started in OIS collaborative planning with DHS clusters around technology needs. Historically in DHS, the focus has been on building IT solutions. This requires a large number of developers designing and building new systems. And as you look at the skills that are required, and really what we're referring to here is application development. That's the only area that we're referring to here. And you can see that about three-quarter of the skills needed is in the development area. Of course, you know, the majority of it in COBOL development or first-generation technology. And then, you know, smaller portions in second and the newer third-generation technology, a smaller number of database analysts and system analysts, a smaller number of project managers, and yet a smaller number of business process engineers. As we move into the new age and, you know, into the 21st century, you know, we've already moved into the 21st century, not quite in DHS as far as information technology is concerned, we are going to be needing a new set of skills and resources. Our focus is shifting from building systems to delivering IT solutions. As you can see, you know, this skill set is completely different from the previous slide. There is a much bigger need for business process engineers. What happens here is that at times we can deliver IT solutions and build IT systems, but business is not necessarily going to be ready to receive that technology and those systems. That becomes a formidable challenge in our organization or any other organization to get the business ready for the technology. Project management becomes an important part of managing IT solutions. And although the legacy application maintainers are a much smaller piece of the pie here, it is a very important piece because these legacy systems are going to be with us for a period of time. And this is a skill set that is slowly disappearing from the market. In fact, we can't even hire people on contract that have the skill and have the knowledge that they need to have about DHS in order to be able to maintain these systems. So we face a challenge of succession planning for folks who are retiring and trying to maintain that body of knowledge as we transition into this new technology. Again, this is one of the most difficult challenges that we face in DHS, and I want to turn it over to our Chief Information Officer, Bill Kroll, to share with you how we plan to do that.
Good morning, Chair Carter and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Kroll, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services. And I think as we go through the balance of our presentation, not so much talking about the background, the history, but that's important, but where we are today and where we're going in the future, you'll have some answers to your very important questions. And the place I'd like to start is where we started about 2 years ago as we developed a business plan or strategy for technology within the Department of Human Services. That was a missing element, vision of the future and where we were going to go. And we started that process by looking at the core strategies of the department from a business perspective. And the first of those is the continue to focus on service and systems integration. Now, obviously, you can put everybody in the same room as we have in the past, but But quite frankly, if they have to go to five different systems to work with you as a client and have to enter information about you five different times in order to service your needs, that's incredibly inefficient. And that's kind of where we are today with these legacy systems. But we understand the problem, and we have plans in place to address that and are addressing it in certain specific areas already. The expansion of a community infrastructure provide prevention treatment services that benefit clients and communities. This has been a real focus in the last 2 years. We're starting to meet with providers, with county governments, with others who provide services to our clients. And for those clients, we need information. And how do we collectively work together to understand, you know, what systems they have and what information they have, and how we can draw upon that to provide the kind of information that we need for ourselves and for other national programs is a real focus right now. And we're finding some opportunities there. The discussions have begun. A direct responsibility of mine in this set of department strategies was the transformation of information systems within the department. And you'll see a lot of that in terms of what we're doing. The whole concept of moving from we build systems to we deliver IT solutions, and that we're willing to go out and buy commercial off the shelf or open source or transfer systems from other states is a major change in strategy, a real transformation, as you just saw in those two slides, and the skilled staff we need in the staff, the skills we need in the staff to support IT, there's a significant change there. We also believe that these strategies, you know, get us to solutions quicker, at lower cost, and with substantially lower risks. And that's why we're implementing those types of strategies. It's important that we improve credibility and accountability of the department. And this is really a difficult challenge when you have the diversity of systems that we have today. And for example, we're working on an application right now that will improve our forecasting and research abilities. In order to do that, we have to go into 17 different systems throughout the department and extract key client information, and then try to reconcile that so we don't have duplication in the final sets of data. We look at clients and try to make sure that they, you know, they aren't duplicated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the as you go through the various strategies, are you also beginning to identify and some estimation of what it's going to cost to make these changes? You know, are we going to get there today, Jim? And also, you know, I want to go back to expanding the community infrastructure to provide prevention and treatment services that benefit clients and communities, mm-hmm. because that's not only a cost to the state, but it will also for those providers and vendors and counties and cities that are doing that are our partners, and what that would mean in terms of its cost drivers, mm-hmm. kinds of things. I didn't see anywhere in this, and I know that we have a role to play because we often ask you to provide certain data and information that's intertwined in all of this, mm-hmm. and whether you put some cost analysis on some of the things that we ourselves ask you to do that may not have been there in the first place.
Do you want? No. Okay. Senator Carter and Senator Winters and Chair Carter, we are spending a great deal of time in understanding what our business requirements are, understanding the value and the payback and how we measure that so that we don't lose track of the fact that we make these investments to achieve certain values. And then an important responsibility of information technology is to give a good, solid estimate of the cost of pursuing these solutions. We've developed a very formalized business case. It is drawn from both public and private sector sources in terms of how to go about doing that type of analysis. We're training our business partners and our own staff on how to do that type of analysis, and that forms the basis of all of the decisions that we make within the department in terms of investment in IT solutions.
Second, Madam Chair, follow. Are there any state, any other states who have accomplished any of the strategies that we're working on? If there are, where are they?
Yeah.
And who are they?
Yeah, the answer is there are other states that are a little bit farther down in implementing the strategy of modernization of their systems. And I would say that some that come to mind, and we're constantly looking at this as we look at what our strategy should be, are Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Actually, Washington State is just probably a year ahead of us, so we're watching what Washington is doing. The county, there are several counties in California that come to mind. There in the child welfare area, the LA Kids, which is the Louisiana system, is very, very interesting and encouraging. Utah has done a lot in the eligibility area with the eligibility system. So yes, there are states, and we monitor that, what they're doing, and try to integrate the best practices that we can see there into our existing systems. And in the MMIS area, we actually have acquired a system that was actually developed for Oklahoma, implemented in another state, and I can't for the life of me.
Was it Ken?
Wisconsin. It was Wisconsin, and now Oregon is implementing that system. So we're very interested in what we can acquire from other states and what's out in the marketplace.
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, in response to your last question, and Mr. Bacobian also asked for some information, we do have some information we can provide the committee. I don't believe we brought it here this morning about some of the major initiatives and the costing behind it, and we'd be happy to write something up. Oh, okay, and I guess we are going to share some of that with you. We think that if we, especially on the data side, can improve our systems and get to where we need to get to, we will certainly be able to provide you with a lot, I think, more timely, accurate information. And I don't see that as kind of a separate initiative. It's all melded together. We need better data so we can provide you with better data, and that's really our goal. In response to kind of the second question you asked, Senator Winters, as you know, as part of the staffing study, we also asked for some process improvement recommendations, and two of the states we are also kind of looking at. And although people would say they may not have had as much success in the human services area in the past, I think Florida and Texas are exploring some pretty progressive ideas around human services delivery. And while we may not be able to glean a whole lot out of that effort, I think there will be things we want to explore and look at further.
Madam Chair, it would be also helpful in as a part of your analysis on cost to include what the cost is based on delay time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm
sure.
Very mindful that we've had the discussion on MIS systems in the past, and, you know, we budgeted for certain things to occur, and then because of budget implications or reductions, mm-hmm. you know, those we've had to shift or change. And sometimes we don't understand what happens when we shift gears and we change, that also, too, has a cost to it. You know, the less efficient that one becomes can often lead to more cost on the
right.
back end. So
absolutely.
It would be very helpful if in part of your information to us that includes what happens with the delays for implementation. Particularly in the area where we're talking about the integrated service delivery piece of it.
Integrated brought something to mind to me, because I'm hearing, and correct me, I'm hearing a fragmented system. And in this fragmented system, and that you're trying to obviously transformate, I'm just wondering how, number one, vulnerable are we as a state in terms of the delivery of services that are expected of us? How vulnerable are we, since you're talking about sometimes 17 different systems, in order to even be able to do reasonable amount of forecasting, number one? And back to the staffing issue, do you have enough people that is communicating between these 17 different systems so that it brings the kind of data to us that that you can forecast a little better, that you might have $50 million down, but $172 is a lot. And so how do we bring those kind of efficiencies in the system under the fragmented system that we have?
Chair Carter, I think that's a great question. And we do have staff people who devote a lot of time in trying to pull data out of the systems and then go through exercise and validating and what we call cleansing the data to make sure that we're not duplicating counts. Our staff are very creative and resourceful, and you know, necessity is the mother of invention, I would say. And so over the years, they develop their own processes and workarounds to get us the best information that they can get, given the fragmented nature of our technological environment. The issue, I think, for us is that it does take a lot more time than it should in being able to get the data and validate the data. Anytime you go through a lot of these kinds of processes, you're right, there's always a possibility that an error or omission or any of those kinds of things is going to have an impact. And I think it was mentioned earlier is that, unfortunately, what we're also seeing is that the people who know what these workarounds are and who know what steps need to be taken to get the data, the end data that we need, are typically people who are probably going to be retiring or leaving the workforce in the next 5 to 10 years, and that's going to create a major issue for us. So we really have to move to a place where the systems are cleaner, we can get data in a more timely fashion, and that a lot of the things we rely on people to do now can be automated. And I think that's what we're striving to move towards.
You scared me when you went to Florida.
Yeah.
Anybody that loses kids in the system, in the way in which Florida loses kids, that at one time it was 5 years span of time when they didn't even know where several thousand of Florida kids were. So I just want to caution you about looking at the Florida system.
Senator Carter, that's a point well taken, and both Florida and Texas have had issues. And anything we would look at from the work that they're doing is going to be looked at very carefully.
You guys vetted. Get away as easy as they do in the other states about this. We will be on you like white.
No, Senator Carter, I understand completely your point and your concern in that area.
Okay, and pray tell me that nobody is taking information home. And we can have some of the other incidences that we've seen in this state in terms of privacy. Now, I need to know that there is a standard by which, when people want to spend extra time doing work, that they're not taking it home.
Senator Carter, one of the things we've done in the last 3 years, actually, is we actually established an Office of Information Security.
Okay.
And the function of that office is to protect not just electronic information, but all information. That includes hard copy information. It's a responsibility we take very seriously, and that kind of led to the formation of the office and the department really kind of dedicating resources just to that issue, to develop policies, standards, protocols to respond to concerns. You know, partly that was driven by the implementation of the HIPAA regulations, but their charge is a lot broader than HIPAA. And one of their responsibilities is to make sure that we don't have the kind of incidents that we've seen recently in the paper and the press around information being lost.
Okay. Thank
you.
Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It struck me when you were doing your rah-rah speech, and I appreciate what you're talking about here, but I felt like I was in a UPS commercial that you all should be wearing brown, because you said we don't build systems, we develop IT solutions. And it just struck me that way. And I appreciate the problem that we have here, and we've spent now 45 minutes talking about it, and we'll probably spend a little more time. There seems to me other problems here than just antiquated equipment and antiquated software and the inability to communicate. And I hope that we're going to be hearing about that through the course of our work, and I trust that we will. And one of the things that strikes me is that there are policies that are created at the federal level and the state level that impact what you do. And how are those integrated into your systems? And it's not all about antiquated computer systems. Mm-hmm. It's about right. getting the information in the first instance. And, you know, I want to also talk to some eligibility workers about how they bring people into the system and, mm-hmm. you know, what happened when we moved people off standard and thought we were saving a bunch of money and they sort of mm-hmm. like jam in a peanut butter sandwich, you know, when you bit into it, they oozed out and they got back into the system. Mm-hmm. So I want to learn more about that. But, you know, I like the approach here. We wear brown, we deliver IT solutions. And mm-hmm. so hopefully you'll tie it up for me in terms of where that's going to take us into really understanding how to solve this problem.
Chair Carter and Senator Walker, I think to your first point, we are going to talk a little bit about the compliance piece and how we respond to mandates that we receive from the federal government as well as the state legislature, like HIPAA and other types of things. We also this morning have some program staff who will be speaking to you later to talk about kind of the challenges they face out in the field around some of the systems that they have to use and how that impacts their work.
Madam Chair, can I just warn the committee that we're about 15 minutes behind time,
yes.
and that would ask maybe shorter and you in shorter questions and you get shorter answers.
Will do.
Madam Chair, it might also be helpful that when to have this particular conversation on the standards that I know that the department is begun to work on at a future meeting, and those standards talk about where they're consistent across the state when we talk about eligibility, because
right.
that's mm-hmm. a piece that in my conversation with Dr. Goldberg, that the agency realized that there is some work that needs to be done in the future that will then mirror some of the concerns that Senator Walker mm-hmm. has expressed of what does that mean with the workers out in the field and how do they determine who's eligible, who's not eligible,
right.
and where we have that kind of consistent information.
Mr. McCovian.
Yes.
Just real quick, and at some point you may be getting to it, I know you use short-term, long-term contractors in the system. How you go out and make that decision when it's feasible to go outside versus inside, short-term versus long-term, that may be covered later yeah. or sometime in a future date.
We'll be covering that later. Chair Carter, let me just finish this last slide. These are, the strategies of the department. And one of the important ones is to addressing the training needs of DHS employees and partners. As we've indicated, there's a lot of churn within the community, and we're bringing in a learning management system, which should be implemented very, very shortly, which will help manage all the programs associated with that, you know, part of the agency's mission. Let me just talk about the major themes that underlie our business plan for IT within the department. There are really six of them. One is the modernization of our systems, and that is the process of consolidating functionality and applying technology to reduce the complexity of the current environment. So hopefully in several years we're not dealing with 17 systems but a lot fewer number to gather the kind of information that we need to look at. We're looking at enterprise solutions, systems that meet the requirements of the entire department. For example, licensing is one I'll talk about a little later on. We have 54 some licensing programs within DHS. The state through the has developed a standard system there called License 2000, and we're taking advantage of that within DHS right now in public health. So an example of enterprise solutions. We talked a little bit about skill transformation, the need to go from a development approach to a we deliver solutions approach. Mm-hmm. That's a mindset change, and it's important that we make that change. We've worked really hard on customer relations. We need to maintain. We support 9,000 plus employees within DHS, and we treat them as customers. We want to listen to them. We want to understand their needs. We can't really address their concerns if we're not listening to their complaints and addressing them. I think we've made considerable progress there, and our surveys show that. It's important that we understand the cultural change that's going on, changes that are going on with the department and also within OIS. And that's why we get these themes, of we deliver solutions, because we're working on cultural change. We're getting people to change the way they think. Being a developer maybe not the best way of delivering solutions to the department. And finally, process improvement. And we'll talk about this again on another slide, but it's very important for us in technology to understand that there's two other elements that have to be changing within the organization. One is process, how we go about doing our business and how we adjust to the systems as we do that. But the other is people, and the capacity of the organization to implement change is a factor. And it's one I've become very sensitive to as the Chief Information Officer, because as we layer all these initiatives on that we all want to get done tomorrow, that we'd love to be able to wave the magic wand and have everything new. But it's a process we go through, and the business can only absorb so much of that at a single point in time. So we have here five strategies that are driving our planning efforts, and collaborative planning is an important part of that, how we manage and govern IT within the organization, change management, which I'll talk about again, portfolio management, looking at the fact this is a very complex business, and rather than thinking of that there's one magic solution to all of our needs within the department, understanding that we have portfolios of activities and functions that we do that have similar characteristics, we should look for commonality in those. We have some that are very different, and commonality doesn't really make sense. And then finally, our basic idea of modernization of the technology that's there. So I'll start with the collaborative planning efforts. This is important. We initially looked at IT as itself as we developed our plan and what we have to do. But we realized one of the things we have to do is align with the business, understand where they're going, what their business needs are, and then start to develop a common dialogue and a common approach to meeting those needs. To date, we recently had a session with the public health group, and there have been some conflicts with in the past between what they wanted and what IT was delivering. We listened to those concerns, and we started to develop a plan with them that will look at their portfolios of applications and their business and start to implement change. And we've done a lot of new systems initiatives up there that are working much better than they have in the past. For example, we have an electronic death registry system that we're implementing that was a purchase, again, an existing commercial off-the-shelf system that we've acquired and are implementing, and that is making very, very good progress, and we're doing the same thing with the laboratory information management system that we're implementing there. So that's an important, part of our process, is working with the business to develop where it is that IT can make the biggest impact. Governance is also a very important variable. We've talked a little bit about some of this. We have established an IT governing council, which is made up of the deputy assistant directors of each of the clusters, and we work together to develop strategies and to review business plans across the department in terms of investments in technology. We have established, very importantly, a information systems management function within each of the clusters to guide what their business needs are, and we meet with them every month to look at what it is that they have as requests and make sure that we're getting those scheduled and implemented. And finally, we have a process for developing business cases, which, as I talked about, is a very comprehensive analysis of what's required, what the benefits and what we'll deliver from those systems, and then what the costs are to implement the technology. Change management is a critical aspect of our strategy within the department. We recognize that change is not simply a technology problem. It is the capacity of the business to absorb and manage change in technology, processes, and people. And we're working really hard to develop methodologies to make sure that those kinds of issues are addressed as we look at modernizing the technology.
So business process. Did that kind of get to the question that you were asking? Did you want to elaborate on that a little more?
Yeah, it is, Madam Chair. Thank you for asking. I was just struck here. Mr. Kroll, how long have you been with the agency?
Senator Walker, I've been with the agency for about 2 years.
I feel a little bit like I'm on American Idol, and I'm going to move you on to the next round because I really like what you're saying. And I don't know, maybe you're new blood, you've got a new way of doing things, but you're bringing a new energy to looking at this issue, and it is an integral part because your IT system, if it's not right, everything else goes every different direction. So I just like what I'm hearing this morning. You're answering the questions, I'm just really pleased with this, and I hope we can keep moving along because it is answering my question, and this is a very large business here, and it actually needs to be run like a business, and I appreciate that you're asking the employees and having that communication with them, because often I don't think we do enough of that, both in state government and in private business, asking the frontline workers how to do our job better, because they actually know better than you do.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, this is what I'm wanting to hear. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Appreciate that. I've talked about portfolios and the complexity of the Department of Human Services, and this slide really.
Let me just ask one.
Yes.
See. Senator Walker just brought up a good story. The reason it's hard to keep the Mr. Krolls in state government is because we don't pay them enough.
Here, here.
And then we start wondering, why is state government inefficient, Mr. Bishop back there? Because, I'm just picking on Bruce because he's my friend. Because if you get what you pay for,
yeah.
And so, you're going to be with us for a little while?
Yes.
Okay.
Chair Carter, I plan to be here for a long time.
Okay.
And you're making it easier, I might.
Chair, we offer other amenities in Oregon besides money.
That's
the ocean, the mountain,
yeah.
The desert. We've got it all here.
They won't put food on the table, Senator.
Yeah.
Go forth, Mr. Kroll.
Senator Thank Carter, you. Before he continues, I do want to. I'm not going to talk about Mr. Krell's salary, but I won't go there. But the issue is not just at Mr. Krell's level, because one of the challenges we face is that when you have your higher level technical staff who are proficient in the newer technologies, they can go to a contractor and make significantly more than we're able to pay them. So we also face that challenge at the technical staff level.
I was thinking about Mr. Maxeresh, and when you look at people with his talent and his skill, private industry come along and pull these kind of people away from us.
Right.
And if we're not careful, we lose highly talented people because of the kind of skills they bring to us. Now, I don't mean to imply that at every level we have this
right.
kind of skill, and you know, because there's a lot to be desired in terms of our requirements. But at the same time, when we lose people in an area as technical as the MIS and the IT system, then really leaves a hole.
That's very true.
Madam Chair, the other part of that segue, because
Senator Winters.
You opened the discussion this morning, I recall, of talking about our unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, I'm mindful of what our investment may be on preparing our children for the high-tech world and keeping them here in Oregon once they graduate mm-hmm. from our universities and our schools. So, it's all interrelated.
Yes, very much so. And I hope that you're taking advantage of the opportunity for internships for mm-hmm. students mm-hmm. who are in this community to come and work with men like this, with people like this, because I'm sure there are women that are very talented, very bright within
yep.
this. You have Miss Patty sitting right there, and I hope that they're bringing, that all of you guys are mentoring other young people in college and letting them spend summers and spending time with you guys so that vacuum that you were talking about, Mr. Psyche, is not so great. Because as we, it happened in the Department of Transportation, you remember about 10 years ago okay. when we were transforming to a new system, and then we made the mistake of not keeping the old system in place while we do the new, because
absolutely.
The legislature thought it would cost too much money to do so. Then the whole thing went wacko,
right.
and we found out, oh, we should have given you the money. Well, it's too late then, because you've made the great mistake that
right.
people have made. So we have to keep one system in place while transforming to the new system. And so how are we going to do that if people are retiring and you're not allowing new people to come on
right.
to learn that information and technology?
Just a quick comment, Senator Carter, is that we actually think that we actually need to start getting to people at the high school level, not at the college level.
Yeah.
And we currently have a business partnership with North Salem High School.
Right.
And we have North Salem High School students who come in to do internships and to work with us
okay.
To learn more about human services and hopefully kind of encourage them to see that as a career opportunity for them. And some of those high school students are amazing.
Yes. Thank you. Before.
Thank you, Chair Carter. I've talked about this a lot, but I think it's a really critical point for, in terms of understanding, not only within DHS, but within the legislature, that this is a complex business, that it has a lot of different functions and activities that it is performing, and you can't necessarily talk about a hospital management system and what it needs to be and think that somehow what you're doing in self-sufficiency is going to have any impact on that. They're just totally different activities. So so these are really the seven major kinds of functional areas that we're looking at. As you know, in the insurance and claim processing, we're implementing a new MMIS, new Medicaid Management Information System. In protective services arena, we're implementing a new SACWIS, a new Child Welfare Information System. I've talked about licensing, and we have a standard licensing system that we're implementing. Vocational rehabilitation services has had one of the first outsourced or commercial off-the-shelf solutions, which didn't get a lot of support from IT, but quite frankly was the best and most current system we had when I arrived here 2 years ago, and we're very supportive of what they're doing. The state is looking at enterprise resource planning, financial, HR, purchasing systems that are much more integrated and would have a very positive impact on issues associated with management, control, accountability, reporting, and other activities. And we're even doing some other things in that area. Public health, I've mentioned. We are looking, and we don't have approval yet, but as a part of the overall look at the hospital here in Salem, we're developing a technology piece of that plan and a recommendation as to how we could modernize a hospital management system that is, you know, 30 plus years old and really, really, you mentioned, I mean, it could break almost any minute and we wouldn't be able to serve, prescriptions and food and the basic services for clients we have in the hospital system. So really critical. Modernizing technology is a key aspect of this. You mentioned earlier the mainframe. Well, actually, the mainframe that we run on is a really small, pretty modern mainframe, and we're going to even be on a more modern one when we move to the new state data center. But the application software that runs it, the code, the 1.5 million lines of code, that's what's old,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we're in the process of replacing. So as we look at, we're looking for flexibility in our IT solutions. We're looking for proven technology. It doesn't make sense for State of Oregon to go out and be a pioneer to develop a new child welfare system. There are good systems in other states that we can transfer into this this state. There's good open source technology that is not free, as they say, but a very cost-effective way of meeting some of our business needs. We're exploring open source and actually have implemented a open source system that helps one of our departments now manage their relationship with providers. So now they have a common system when they're dealing with their providers where they can go to. So you can't talk to this person in the department and get that answer and talk to this person and get another answer. They're all looking at the same information in the same system. It's called a customer relationship management system, but essentially we're using it as a provider relationship management system. We're looking to leverage statewide opportunities. The state data center is an important part of that we're all moving towards now. And we can build interfaces to systems that allow us to look across, where we need to look across systems in order to get to the information the department needs. We're streamlining and reducing the number of systems in that process. I have really two to three quick slides that I want to review. And the first one I'm not going to spend much time on. We're implementing a new transfer system from another state, which I said was Oklahoma. The implementation will meet our requirements, all of our federal and state requirements for a MMIS system. That's really important. We're doing the same thing with SACWIS. And the new system integrates functionality of over 11 separate systems. And if you go to the next slide, this shows you the level of complexity that we're dealing with in these major portfolios of business areas. If you look on the light, the legacy system was developed in the 1980s. In 1993, a major change was made in that system. It was initially purchased as a fee-for-service system, and then we implemented managed care, and we had to modify that system to provide for managed care. That has been an ongoing system. And then if you look at the top here, all of these other systems were added later on, and they're like bolt-ons to the system. So it's very hard to integrate or look at information across various aspects. There was a pharmacy, an electronic eligibility verification vendor system, an electronic document management system where we can scan paper claims and then add those into the system, decision support, fraud and abuse, housekeeping. All of these different systems, there are about 10 of them there, that were added in. And as you can see, as we reach the implementation of the new MMI system in the fall of 2007, which is our scheduled date, all of those systems will now be in one integrated MMIS application. So we will have dramatically reduced the complexity. We will have integrated these systems. We will not have the multiple data entry issues and all the other things that we mentioned earlier. And finally, in this particular situation, we're planning to implement a new payment system that we just recently developed called Express into that system, which will handle developmental disability programs and also some of the mental health and addictive services programs. A total payment over the biennium of about $800 million in those areas will be added into the MMIS and we'll have even more streamlined systems. And on the next slide, SACWIS is approaching a similar kind of effort. We were developers. We developed a child welfare system called FACIS, Family and Child Information System. It was 7 to 8 years in the effort. At the end of that effort, we had reached only about 18% of the federal requirements embedded within that system. The technology we had chosen was called Smalltalk, and it had actually become a dinosaur. Nobody was using that. We couldn't even find employees to program in Smalltalk. It was a very early on language that just didn't make the commercial. It wasn't commercially successful. Given all of that, we went to the federal government and said, "We really need to stop our efforts here in this area. we're not going to make, we're not going to get to the conclusion we want, and go out and look again for a transfer system from another state that that has these capabilities. And there, you know, Utah, I think, Louisiana, I mentioned, Wisconsin, all have implemented new modern systems that fully meet all of the federal requirements, and would also be very capable of meeting the requirements in Oregon. So with that, we complete our 30 minutes of overview. Our IT systems at DHS. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Clyde?
Thank you for your comment.
Chair Carter, if we're ready to move on,
okay.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to invite two people from our program area to the table. I'm going to ask Meg Kilgore-Cathcart, who's the manager of the Employment and Financial Benefits section of our Senior and People with Disabilities Cluster. And I'm also going to invite Paul Mills, who is the Business Integrity Coordinator for SDA2, which is Multnomah County. And they're going to be talking to you about some of the technological challenges they face in the delivery of client services. So they're going to come up back. Yeah, so you guys are starting. So if it's okay with you, we'll have Meg lead off and then Paul.
Good morning and welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm Meg Kilgore-Cathcart, and I hate to point out an error immediately, but actually I manage an area that is does information systems coordination and also has the provider payments for seniors and people with disabilities. My area has the staff that work directly with end users to determine what systems needs are, to assist them, provide technical assistance to them when they're having trouble with the system, and to respond to issues that have come into the help desk, questions about how the systems work that actually involve the business side of it, business usage, and how the system is meeting our needs, those kinds of questions. So we use the client population that we work with, seniors and people with disabilities, obviously seniors, people with physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, and to some degree mental health issues. We use most of the systems, I think, that the department has. We use the current MMIS. We also have most of the subsystems. In that previous slide where you saw the core and then the extra systems, most of those systems are systems that we use most of the time. We use the eligibility systems, the food stamp systems, all of those kinds of systems. Also, I'm sure that you've been briefed on Medicaid Part D, at the Medicare Part D issues. So the systems that support all of that, our end users are using all of those systems. I was asked actually to specifically discuss one example of a the way that these many, many systems impact our users, our end users. I think today you've heard a lot of things about the complexity, you know, the variety, so on and so forth. But I just want to talk about something that's really simple, that affects them every day, that kind of gives you a real feel for how frustrating this is, and that's issuing client notices. Every one of these systems that we've talked about issues notices to clients, notices about their benefits, about if their benefits are ending or if they're not going to receive benefits. And each one of these systems has its own method for issuing those notices. And it's very important to us that notices are issued in alternate formats when that's needed, that they're issued promptly, that they're readable. All those things are important to us. And yet every time you need a notice to be issued from a specific system, it's almost like Groundhog Day. You sort of start over again explaining what you need, how you need it, how the system's going to meet that need. And so that would be, I mean, it's a simple thing, you don't think about it, but every day, over and over, these complexities, this one simple thing affects the lives of our end users and of our clients and our providers. I don't know if you want me to. I mean, that's really all I. That's the specific
Questions?
Example. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'm Paul Mills. I'm the Business Integrity Coordinator for SDA 2. SDA 2, if you don't understand the way we're broken down, is compromises Multnomah County. And the people my clients, are actually the staff of SDA 2, our vendors, and through them, our clients. I've worked mostly with the child welfare and the self-sufficiency staff in my SDA. My position deals more with business aspects for continuity of services, payment issues, security of not only privacy information, but for payments, what risk we at the local levels will be taking in different systems, how we handle that, and then the program issues of how we provide services to our clients and making these things easier. One of the things that we've been doing up in SDA 2 is we've tried to test small tests of different types of technology. We tried a digital pen for a while and found out good advertising, not so useful on the field services. We've tried things called quick pads for taking notes in the field that, again, it's not bad technology, but it really doesn't meet our needs a lot of times. One of the things we just recently tested on a larger scale was Cyber Secretary, which on the child welfare side, the staff were very enthusiastic about it, cited that they had saved a vast amount of time where they could call in while they're in the field, dictate their notes to an off-site location, secure location. Within an hour or so of that, they would be able to access it through the internet and a secure internet link, all their notes that they had found. Instead of having to write hand notes while they're in the home or in the car, drive back to the branch, transcribe those into writing. And as Meg was saying on Groundhog Day, we have that situation repeating throughout a number of our systems. Child welfare probably more common than self-sufficiency. The home visit. They're coming back and they're transcribing the notes of the home visit. They're transcribing court reports that we're going to submit to the court that takes information out of our FACES system now.
So, Mr. Mills, I hate to ask you this question, but if we're talking about the kind of efficiencies that you're explaining here, pray tell me why the person that called in, maybe this question is for you at the state. Why, Ms. Psaki, the person that called in to Human Services and reported the situation that a foster child was living in, mm-hmm. and where I have never seen such level of filth in my mm-hmm. whole life. If those kind of efficiencies in place, why didn't we act more expediently in trying to get that child out of that home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Senator Carter, I'm not familiar with that particular case, and so
Let's just
in general.
Let's talk in general. If indeed these kind of efficiencies, I will applaud you for that. If these kind of efficiencies are in place, that a person can call Cyber Secretary and give notes on a particular issue, and you have people who are basically your police, you don't call them that. I'm trying to think of another word.
The child service workers.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
People. Why can't we move faster on dealing with those kind of issues where there is an immediate investigation to corroborate the story? And if the story is corroborated, that we don't find a place faster to get a kid out of a situation similar to that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Carter, I think that's a very good question, and as you're aware of, I'm sure, and other members of the committee may be aware of, we are in the process of looking at all our internal processes around child welfare and how we respond to all reports, kind of based on some of the recommendations by the Holder in the Wayne Holder report. And I would say that technology definitely is a tool we use, but besides technology, we have to have good processes, good protocols,
okay,
properly train our caseworkers.
I'm going to bring you guys on this one.
Okay.
I'm your supporter, but I'm your critic.
No, I understand.
I'm going to ding you on this one, yes. And I want you to get back to us with some kind of report in terms of how are you handling cases of that nature. Let's talk about the lap time in which a report comes in like that with pictures showing you the whole story, and we don't move more expeditiously. Number two, I have been reading a letter from Eugene, Oregon, from this grandmother regarding a grandchild that is in foster care, and we as an agency are not moving to help. So even though she gave you guys compliments, to try to bring families together to deal with these issues. I don't take a second place with us in this state in terms of trying to bring families together. That's good. But I just don't think the people have to live in those kind of situations. I don't think this grandmother from Eugene, did you get a copy of the email?
I did.
Would you explain it a little more?
Well, I referred it on to Senator Morissette. It's
okay.
His constituent, and my recollection is the grandparents were given the children to take care of, which is often the case today. We have a lot of grandparents raising mm-hmm. children again.
I'm a witness.
And it's just not moving through the system as quickly as they would like, and there were some other issues. But
those are the kind of issues that I'm talking about, because obviously when I listen to Mr. Mills talk about the kind of deficiencies that are in the system,
sure.
It just appeared to me that something is happening within the framework of that system where appropriate people are not getting what they're supposed to have, like whomever the initial investigator is before they call for
right.
Protective Services.
Yep. Senator Carter, I would say to you that if we leave one child in that kind of a situation, shame on us, and it's our responsibility, and we need to be committed to make sure we correct that kind of situation. That being said, I think there are two things. Number one, we have to make sure that the efficiencies, the tools, and the training that our child protective service workers, and I think we would all agree that that's one of the toughest jobs that people have to do in state government. But we have to make sure we provide them with the support, the training, and the tools they need to do the job. That being said, I think that Director Goldberg and I are both personally committed to making sure that if we have glitches in our system and if kids are not being cared for in an appropriate manner personally, we want to be involved and we want to fix those types of things.
Yeah. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need to ask a question. You talked about cyber secretary. Mm-hmm. My question is, does that tool exist statewide, number one? Clyde, or is it in the Portland metro area only? Because one of my concerns has been is the inconsistency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may have one part of the region or part of the state that is using one particular tool or mm-hmm. and not existing in another part of the state.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about if we're going to really do our job, we need to make certain that standards are consistent, our language and our practice and protocol is consistent throughout the state, particularly in child welfare.
Mm-hmm.
But so my question is, does this exist statewide?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I can't speak to that, but... Maybe Paul or Mr. Crowell.
It was tested statewide on a limited basis throughout the state. The problem was that there was a lot more use, and every time we found one use, we found another use for it, and it outstripped its funding in short order.
It was tested.
It was tested.
And in during the test period, it was determined to be valuable. It was determined to be an efficient tool.
Yes.
And then somewhere along the line, the decision was made not to have it continued or not to roll it out statewide. Is that what I'm hearing?
The funding, from what I understand, was not adequate to continue at the higher level that we kept finding uses for.
Why don't you get back to us?
Correct.
Yes.
We will.
Okay.
Chair
Carter.
Then just continuing, I think in child welfare and self-sufficiency both, we find where our times where we're entering in data, as Mr. Krause said, multiple times. And the more times you enter in the same data, the more obvious chances there are for errors somewhere on the long way. But it also adds to inefficiencies. If we could pull up more data automatically on an automated format of some sort to for our caseworkers and case managers to complete their jobs, plus the local data that we're trying to capture in addition to what the statewide data is, so we can more closely define our problems where we need to increase our proficiency or to change our actions to increase our accuracy rates on both the child welfare and the self-sufficiency programs.
Thank questions?
The only question that I would ask to make your job more efficient and effective, what, and you're on the line, you work with it every day, what changes would you make?
I think one of the changes that's already happened is the new computer systems that we've just recently fielded to the agency. We've gotten out what I consider a lot of antique computers. It's really speeded up the process. Made the programs we do have work better and increased efficiency quite a bit. Further changes, one of the changes I would like to see is something that's also being developed now, is a single sign-on. Part of our problem right now is I log into the network. I then have to have another login to go into the group-wise email system. If I'm going into the FACES child welfare system, I need a separate login. If I'm going to cross-index information onto the TRAC system, I need a separate login for that. Now, if I'm then, for some reason, looking at a payment issue and I'm looking at a contract, I have to have a separate login to get into DHS Central and into CSTAT. And that doesn't count my phone system, my pager, getting into the building or anything else. That's just normal things. We are 5-6 sign-ons to research one piece of information. And all of these logins, because of security, change every 6 months.
Could I add?
I was going to say, I see you just chomping at the No, go ahead.
Well, one of the things you mentioned, which I think is an important factor for us, is we did recently get a significant upgrade of the desktop equipment, which made our applications work better. Mm-hmm. But one of the problems that we've had as we build these systems is that when we have a difficulty with a system, we sort of just move on to another system, and we're not really maintaining the ones that we have. So we don't completely abandon them, so you don't have to use them anymore, but we'll take part of the functionality or something and move it to another system. So we're not really investing in maintaining what we also have, which is something that you had mentioned earlier also. So I think that's one of our big issues. When we move on, if we're not completely moving on, we need to be mindful of the maintenance required to keep the things running.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. That plays into what Senator Winters was talking about, the cyber secretary. We're both kind of a little stunned here that we just stopped using a program because it really, really works, but it costs a little bit of money. But, Ms. Cathcart, one of the things that you mentioned at the outset is one of the most simple things I've heard yet, but it's really an important piece, and I think it saves money and is efficient, and that's having a notice system that works.
Mm-hmm.
That's really simple. And I thank you for talking about it, because we might not think it's a big deal, but the people on the other end do, and you do, when you have to go in and reinvent the wheel every single day. So mm-hmm. I think that's a very simple one I think should be addressed pretty quickly.
Mr. Mill?
Chair, Senator Carter, I think I don't have anything to add at this time.
Thank you. We appreciate both of you coming this morning from your regular work day to be able to talk with this committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Carter, if we're ready to move on.
Ready to move on?
I will ask Mr. Paxaresh to rejoin me at the table along with Sean Jacobson, who is our Deputy Chief Financial Officer. We want to spend the next few minutes talking to you about systems, environment, and challenges in the budgeting, accounting, and recovery section of the department. So I'll turn it over to them at this time.
Good morning, Senator Devlin.
Good morning.
For the record, again, my name is Faribor Spaksuresh, Administrative Services with DHS. Information systems play an important role in financial accounting and budget preparation. We are fully aware that the legislature and this committee demands accountability. You know, you want us to be able to manage our budget. You want us to be able to manage accurate information, and you want that information to be timely. The biggest challenge that we face, and I think if we go back to the presentation earlier today, talking about systems that are not connected to one another and systems that don't communicate with one another do not provide us with the tools necessary to be able to do that. I think that ideally we should be able to go to any manager in any organization that wants to be financially responsible and ask them, are you within budget? You know, how much did you spend last month? And how does that expenditure compare to what you had budgeted for? Without answering those questions, we cannot be accountable. And currently in DHS, we cannot answer those questions because, you know, we do not have part of the problem is that we don't have the systems that can provide the information so that we can answer those questions.
Can I ask that question? You said we don't have the systems. Is it also that if I'm looking at the various units or in the field, that they actually have a budget allocation with which they're responsible for? So then that would be two pieces of it. Mm-hmm. You know, system plus that, let's say, for example, within Multnomah County, that Multnomah County is provided with X amount of dollars to do alcohol and drug treatment or whatever. And so that particular region is responsible for managing those dollars. Is that what you're talking about? We do not have that kind of a system.
Senator Winters, Sean Jacobson would be expanding on that notion. The problem exists in several different levels. You know, in DHS, we do break the budget down by clusters and by those field offices. The problem is that the accounting structure and the budget structure do not match one another. I can only be accountable to you if I have both pieces of information, if I know what my budget is and what I have spent within a given period of time. If I'm missing one of those pieces of information, again, I cannot be financially accountable. So, you know, Sean will be speaking about that. I just wanted to add a piece, and that is that the department leadership is serious about this, fixing this problem. Both Dr. Goldberg and our deputy, Mr. Psyche, have expressed their desire and their intent to bring financial accountability back to DHS. We are working on several fronts to address that. State Controller John Radford has been working with us. In fact, as we speak today, there are a group of state employees from Oregon visiting Michigan and within the next day or so Arizona to look at their financial systems. We are also working with the state of Washington to, going back to our earlier presentation, trying to do this with financial accountability. We don't necessarily want to spend millions of dollars on financial systems. We want to know what's already available, what practices exist in other states, and then try to do the best we can within DHS. With that, I'll turn it over to Sean Jacobson, and she'll go to Senator Devlin.
Senator Winters, did you have a follow-up?
I'll wait and listen, because I'm very, very concerned about this particular topic. You know, when we look at, even we talk about forecasting, we're not going to really do a good job of forecasting if we don't deal with this particular issue of financial accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're inter-
I had a question, a clarification, actually. When I'm thinking, let me say on the more straightforward side, I won't go to a county that's performing a service for the state or to a county that's performing a service that's ultimately performed by a nonprofit. I'll just stay at the state level. A branch office for the Department of Human Services out there. Whatever the current title is for that operations manager. I kind of have a feeling that if they had a budget, what they would have a budget for is maybe their human resources, their personnel expenditures, their office M&S expenditures, but they wouldn't probably really have a budget for how many clients they had for the Oregon Health Plan, how many clients they had for food stamps, how many clients. And those are, quite honestly, TANF, where the large dollars are.
Correct.
So at the central level, do you have a more clear idea when an area of the state is actually, well, more cases are coming forward than you would anticipate? Because I'm not so sure that the operations manager at the individual branch is even tracking that. That's my basic question. I mean, it's one thing to simply track the expenditures for the individual office, which are probably relatively modest compared to the number of dollars that are going out in terms of benefits, but who actually tracks the number of dollars that are going out in terms of benefits?
Senator Devlin, with your permission, I'd like to ask Vic Todd, who is our Assistant Director for Finance and Policy Analysis, to come up. He's could answer that question for you and probably any follow-ups you may have.
Senator Devlin, my name is Vic Todd. I'm Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. The question you're asking is obviously a complex question in that the way that the program expenditures are monitored, they are monitored at central office. Field offices do track what their client activity is, although in a lot of cases it'll be not necessarily a formalized tracking process. So historically, the department had various means that the different divisions used in terms of what responsibility the individual branches would have with respect to their budgets. So that's what's created some of the issues in the new reorganization configuration, in that the department doesn't have a department-wide process for determining what level of budget should be assigned to which managers, because you're correct in that their focus tends to be more on the delivery of services than it is on what is my specific budget for this area.
I'm just trying to get a clear feel for how the department is able to tell when forecasts are not accurate and how soon that they're able to tell that whether they're going under or above. And obviously, in most cases, there isn't really much corrective action you can take to them going above or below. It's simply a matter of the number of people that qualify that come through the door, or that various interests out there who are advocates try to get to your door, basically, to get services. So, but I'm just trying to get. I've seen. I have to give you just a little brief history. In the early 70s, I was in a communications unit for the Marine Corps, and we tracked hundreds of pieces of equipment and tens of thousands of different pieces of replacement parts for that equipment, and on actually a system that was actually probably very old, but was still actually an online system, in a sense. In the sense that we got printouts constantly of what was happening, and that was 30 some years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to see how much information your managers actually have to know what's actually going on in the field.
Chair Carter, Senator Devlin, there is a tremendous amount of information that is produced by all of these various systems. And there is continued production of data reports around client counts by branch and so forth. So there is a lot of information that's out there for the individual managers.
Okay. I guess a follow-up.
Senator Winters?
I'm trying to understand.
Senator Winters, excuse me for a minute. That was just asking the question that make us, we go, Senator Devlin. Senator Winters, go forward.
In looking at who manages what, and particularly in looking at when we talk about the issue of forecasting and going beyond forecasting and how do you control when at this level we give you X amount of dollars or X amount of numbers to work with and you're monitoring cases. However, the field doesn't have responsibility for the overall budget. Is that what I'm hearing? Then as a manager, and you know, I've coming from the child welfare, coming from that field, there's nothing there for me to control the input, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so we really do not have, as an organizational structure, where managers in the branches and in the field are actually saying, I have X amount of dollars, and therefore when I get to this point within my various area, I have to stop intake, or have to stop eligibility. And coupled with that is the issue of whether or not there are standards across the state on who is eligible. Have I stated the problem correctly?
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, I think you've described the scenario correctly in that the branch offices, really, their role is to deliver the services. And because a lot of the services they're delivering are entitlement programs, we don't have a cap. Most of the programs are not a cap program situation. So if a person comes in, the staff are going to determine what they're eligible for. Mm-hmm. So if, I'm not sure if I'm fully addressing though what you're.
Yeah, I mean, you're stating I think we correctly. The only problem is where you have an inconsistency of standards. If standards are not the same in eligibility across the state, then that leaves it to the discretion, if you will, of the worker to determine who is eligible.
Am I hearing?
Is that what I'm hearing? I mean, I'm trying to get this straight.
I think I hear two different things. I'm hearing you say, because of federal mandates, that there is no cap of the kind of services that any community, or I'm trying to think of that, there's not agency, any office, mm-hmm. that you guys operate across the state where you say, I have reached my cap for the day in terms of these services, and that's all I can spend. What I hear you saying is that there's no such thing, because you run into federal guidelines. The state would be sued if you wouldn't provide a level of service to any community across the state. So therefore, at the moment, you don't have any means of knowing how much any community spent in one day in order to make an assessment of how much service is going to cost for this day all over the state. And you said the standard is the same, but you don't know how to determine how much you spent because there is no cap. Am I just about right?
Senator Carter, we do track how much we're spending during the course of a day, so we do have that information available. I think what one of the challenges we face is that if a client comes into the door and they are eligible, they meet the eligibility criteria for a specific program, we don't have a choice. We must serve that client.
So
however,
you do know how much you're spending on the course of the close of a day. It's just that you cannot cap it, so right. You can say we're spending $500,000 in Multnomah County, we're spending $10,000 in Clackamas, we're spending $25,000 in Yamhill. Well, of course you don't do that,
mm-hmm.
but until the close of that day, because there is no cap, and because eligibility is one and the same across the state, you don't know how much you will have spent until the close of day.
You take that one. But I do want
to...
Yeah.
Clyde wants to get... Because he knows what I'm talking about.
Yes,
the eligibility standards are not consistent across the state.
Senator, I really want to hear that.
Right.
And therein lies the problem.
Go ahead. I'll take that one. Take her first piece about this. Knowing where we are, what we're spending for services.
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I'm not sure where we are.
We're on the eligibility standards.
Senator Carter, I think, let me do this. We are able to track what we're spending on services during the course of the day.
I'm clear that
what I want to address is Senator Winters' concern, and Senator Winters has talked to us about this, and we are in agreement with Senator Winters that in determining eligibility, there is a certain amount of latitude that people have in interpreting policy. And I think Senator Winters is correct in saying that in some areas of the state, things may be interpreted differently than they may be in other areas of the state, and we agree with that statement. That being said, one of the things that Dr. Goldberg has charged us with, and I will be working with him on this issue, is to make sure that that doesn't happen and that the standards are consistent.
God, you're about to get me. No wonder you catch hell. No wonder this department catch hell.
Because
if I'm in Marion County and an employee tells me that under this criteria I'm eligible, but somebody else in Multnomah County say that with this same kind of criteria I'm not eligible, something is wrong with that picture.
Senator Carter, I couldn't agree with you more. And all I can tell you is that Dr. Goldberg and I are in the process of saying what are the areas that we really need to pay attention to and to hold people accountable to and to put standards in place. And even more importantly, I think, not just put standards in place, but put systems in place so that people are held accountable to those standards.
Why do you guys give Lars Larson so much ammunition?
Right.
I mean, really and truly, because the first thing I'm going to say to you right now is that if a black person and a white person came and asked for particular services, or Hispanic or whatever, and one caseworker says yes, another one says no, you got a lawsuit right there.
Potentially, Senator Winters.
Something is wrong with this picture here.
Yes. Senator Carter, I agree with you.
Senator Carter, I'm not about giving anybody ammunition, because we have asked them to be transparent.
Mm-hmm.
We have asked them to come forward to us with how, when they identify issues and concerns. I want to commend them, you know, for saying this is something we've identified and we need to have consistent standards across the state.
Senator Winters, this is not rocket science. I'm not talking about this generation of people at DHS. This should have been an issue settled years ago, not on your watch, Dr. Goldberg's watch, Mr. Psyche. When you are dealing with public entities, you have the kind of standards so that nobody can call you on discrimination, subjectivity, and all of these kind of things. I mean, there should be a standardized approach to who's eligible and who is not, because you have federal government intervention, you have state intervention, then you have local communities. That is too much power to give any one caseworker in this state to say whether a person is eligible or not eligible. You guys going to drive me crazy.
Well, Senator Carter, I agree with you. And to tell you the truth, as far as Dr. Goldberg and I are concerned, how we got here is not our issue. Our issue is how do we fix it? And we're accountable to you once problems like these are identified to put solutions in place to deal with those issues. And that's what our charge is. That's what our responsibility is. And what we're saying to you is that as we identify these, we will not only come and tell you what these issues are, but we're going to tell you how we deal with them, and then we're going to be accountable to you in implementing solutions.
I've been around a long time, and let me tell you, these are the kind of things I'm going to be your worst nightmare on. Because there should be standards in terms of operational procedures, and there should be standards in terms of who's eligible and who's not, and it should not be based on subjectivity whatsoever. So I will be your worst nightmare, and you may as well know it now. And Patty, we can't go no place and discuss it. It must be done, and it must be done with a level of immediacy.
Senator Carter, I agree with you, and I'm counting on you being my worst nightmare. I'm hoping we get to a place where you're not my worst nightmare, because we're doing the things that we need to do to fix these kinds of issues. And I know that both you and Senator Winters, Senator Walker, Senator Devlin, as well as a host of other senators and representatives, we know what your expectations are, and we know we're accountable to that.
Madam Chair, I didn't want to put any more complexity in this, but it looks like I'm going to. And this is not meant as a criticism, nor as any belief that somehow the system should change in this regard. But it's not only your workers that are determining who's eligible for benefits. I don't know in cases of how many different programs, but I do know, particularly in the instance of food stamps, the AAAs approve people for food stamps. There may be others that approve people for the, they may also approve people probably for the Oregon Health Plan, or I don't know if that's true or not. But you've got multiple levels of different people determining eligibility, and your eligibility requirements from the federal level are not always as clear as person might think on the outside that they should be. And then when you talk about just being entitled, going on my limited knowledge here, is that there have been issues around FEOP in terms of how many cases you could actually have for FEOP. Mm-hmm. We all know that you're coming down to a certain point, but you're going to have to start to manage the standard population. So somebody that's in an office in Grants Pass and somebody that's in an office in Hood River is going to have to know how many openings that you have for the standard population, mm-hmm. and you're going to have to make some probably almost based on whatever criteria is developed under who has a greater right to get on the standard population than someone mm-hmm. else. So I just think this complexity is going to get even more than what you have now. And I'm just how many examples are there of outside agencies approving people for benefits?
Senator Carter,
I know that they're reviewed by the agency, but there are other entities that actually determine eligibility.
Chair Carter and Senator Devlin, you're correct. As you know, large parts of our service delivery system are contracted out either through counties or nonprofits or other types of governmental agencies. So we do have relationships with providers where eligibility determination is made on the long-term care side, on the food stamp side, on OHP benefits. And so there are a number of programs where the service and eligibility determination is made through another entity, contracting with DHS, someone we have a relationship with. Okay. But I appreciate your comments, Senator Devlin, but and it is a complex situation, but what we have to do is we have to put a system in place so someone who's eligible for benefits in Grants Pass would also be eligible for the same benefits in Multnomah, who would also be eligible for the same benefits in Clackamas. And it shouldn't matter in programs where we have these kinds of overarching eligibility requirements, it shouldn't matter where you reside in the state as far as your eligibility for programs. And that's our responsibility.
Okay. We don't have a lot of time.
I'm just glad we're having this discussion.
Okay.
Because it is critical. It's absolutely, when I had my conversation with Dr. Goldberg, if we cannot develop an intake system or an eligibility system where we all understand it and we know who's eligible and who is not eligible, we're going to continue have the issue of not knowing. I don't care how good we get at forecasting. If we don't know what we're inputting into that forecasting system, we cannot manage that system. And so we've had this discussion of to assure that whether we're talking food stamps, whether we're talking the Oregon Health Plan, whatever we're talking about, we need to be consistent throughout the state so that caseworkers, wherever they are, the worker knows what is expected.
Right.
And so I just wanted to say that Dr. Goldberg and Clyde have been responsive when we started talking about where do we think the problem areas are. And their conversation with me, I said, we need to look at eligibility. And I also need to add that, you know, we as policymakers need to also be mindful, and I hope that the agency does, when we lay different requirements on them that also impacts this particular issue. I think we need to know that up front. We need to know what the implications are, because we, too, sometimes make requirements that will sometimes skew these whole things of standards. And so I need to put that on record as well. We're very good at giving direction at times from this side without understanding its impact and its implication on the delivery of services.
So you want to share, Ms. Edwards, walk through your comments?
Not at this time, Madam Chair. I was upstairs retrieving the email you'd referenced earlier, and I'll hand that off in a bit, and I watched on television while you engaged in this very spirited debate.
Welcome to our committee.
You know, it's one that a lot of us have been thinking about, so I anticipate we're going to have a very spirited discussion as we continue.
And Senator Carter, if I can just make one more comment. I will say that our caseworkers who work with clients every day have a very tough job, and I think a lot of them do a very good job. And I don't want to give the committee the impression that the system, that there's not a lot of good things that happen in the system, and there is some consistency that happens. However, that being said, we also know that there are areas where there are inconsistencies, and those are the ones we have to focus in on and take care of.
Thank you. Christian?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, with that, we'll go to Sean Jacobson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, I'm Sean Jacobson, and I'm the new Deputy Chief Financial Officer for the Office of Financial Services and DHS. And I'm going to shift gears on you a little bit and talk about some of our internal systems, the statewide accounting system that we use and the budget system, and some of the issues and concerns that we have. I'm not going to touch on the forecasting system since Judy Moore Peterson will be up here. I'm going to kind of high grade so that you have enough time to hear from her today, because forecasting, I'm sure, is of big interest to each of you. I'm going to be working off of this document here. This is a very stimulating document with boxes. And first I want to talk about the accounting system. DHS uses the statewide relational standard accounting and reporting system. You guys may know the acronyms RSTARS or SFMS or SFMA. In the last biennium, we actually converted our seven very unique divisions into one reporting entity in the RSTARS system. For those of you in the private sector, that is similar to taking seven fairly large corporations with different books of record and chart of accounts and melding them into one, so a pretty daunting feat. I would say that DHS uses the state's accounting system to its max. We use pretty much all of the layers and all of the data fields in the system. We collect expenditure data from a program perspective, from an organizational perspective. Program perspective, for example, food stamps. From an organizational perspective, we collect costs for each service delivery area down to each office. We collect costs for every grant that comes in the program, and we collect costs for our major projects like MMIS or SACWIS. So it's a pretty complex, pretty robust accounting system. If you move over to, actually, one other thing I want to mention about the system is that we still have 22 interface systems that go into our accounting system. 14 of these are actually check writing systems like MMIS or the Child Welfare IIS system. And for each system that is an interface system, it makes our work a little more complex because we end up doing a three-way reconciliation between a subsidiary system, our state accounting system, and the Treasury. So in that way, DHS is unique with all of our interfaces. We also have six receiving systems, systems that accept checks, transfers, cash, and those also interface into our accounting system. I'm going to shift gears and talk about the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System, ORBITS, which I'm sure you guys are very familiar with. And obviously, this is newer technology than our STARS. And DHS's budget, as you know, is developed at a cluster level, and it goes down to a pretty low programmatic level. For example, the food stamps program. You guys have seen the detailed budget for DHS. Last by name, for the first time, we actually have an alignment between our accounting and our budget system at this program level, so that there is a connection programmatically for food stamps budgets to food stamps expenditures in the system. Where we have capacity issues is that the ORBITS system was not developed to drive budgets down to a lower level. That is left to agency responsibility, which is part of the reason we're talking to you today, which is the lovely oval on this diagram, which is our interest in looking at a financial planning and reporting system or tool. What you've already discussed, Senator Winters mentioned, I think Senator Devlin mentioned, is that we have budget and expenditures for the food stamps program. However, a service delivery manager may have their expenses, but they may not always know what their budget is. And so it's not always helpful for them to find out that they spent $1,000 in office supplies and they don't know what they were supposed to spend in office supplies. And that is being done somewhat, and if you have questions, I think Vic can give you more detail. But it's being done in technology like Microsoft Excel, which those of you that have used those types of technology know they're not robust, and it's easy to make mistakes. And for an agency the size of DHS, it's a huge workload.
So, Clyde, on the operations side, do you budget in terms of your field offices based upon any level at all of expenses for daily operations for those different communities and field offices?
Mm-hmm. Chair Carter, are you asking about expenditures in the kind of the personal services and operating expenses,
yeah,
or programs?
Is there a standard procedure for you to know how much it costs to run one field agency, one field, I don't know whether you call it agency, I don't know the word,
yeah,
here, one,
sure,
field office,
right,
to another?
Yeah. Senator Chair Carter, we do have information that we can drill down to by office as far as personal services, which means, you know, the expenses related to the people who are in the office.
Okay.
And we also can have information that deals with the travel and the...
Can you estimate other services, whether it's magazines, pencils, ink pens, you know, those kind of things? But those are the things that add up.
Yeah, Chair Carter, we're able to do that, especially I think the expenditure information is readily available. The budget information is a little harder.
So it's the people issues, how many people we provide services for any one day, that you don't really know or can't get a handle of, can't project.
Chair Carter, we know that to a certain level. I'm not sure that we can drill down to the branch level, but we know those expenses down to a certain level.
Okay. Thanks.
Continuing on, what our desire is that we are looking for a consolidated system that will allow us to drive our budgets down to the lowest level in the organization. We want every manager to have a budget to expenditure report. We would like to have that view from a programmatic and organizational view. So essentially, you would have at minimum two eyes looking at expenditures at any time. You would have the food stamps manager looking at their budget, and then you would have a service delivery manager also looking at their budget and expenditures, and there would be that kind of cross. The idea is the lower that you can get that information in the organization, the more accountability you're going to have. The more transparency that you have in your data, I think the better off that we will all be. To let you know what we are doing to date towards this initiative, is that, as was mentioned earlier, we have a few people that are visiting Arizona and Michigan this week. We selected those states because they use R-STARS, the same accounting system. So among many things that we're going to ask them, we're curious as to how they're integrating their budget data and what reporting tools and technology they use. And we are meeting both with their Department of Administrative Services and their DHS entity. This week, a group of us are going to Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield and Standard Insurance. They both have a lot of data, and they have data warehousing initiatives. And so we're going to go up and talk to them. How are they handling all their data? How is data warehousing working for them? And how are they extracting data? We have had on-site presentations by two vendors, a company called Cognos and a company called Hyperion. And these two vendors are considered top of the line in financial planning and business intelligence tools. A lot of large corporations use these tools. So they've done presentations for us. We are interviewing other state agencies. This oval and this problem is not unique to DHS. There is no statewide system for financial planning and reporting, and other agencies have put in systems, so we're talking to them to find out, you know, what did they develop in-house. We also are doing lessons learned on different reporting tools that were developed by the seven divisions prior to our consolidation. To see if any of those initiatives are scalable, if any of them can be expanded to agency-wide efforts. And with that, I will say thank you.
Questions? So, you know, sometimes
I made a bad comment.
Sure. Don't regret it.
His question. Matt, sorry. Can I repeat the comment? I asked if you went to Providence and checked out their security system with the data.
That would be no. Thank you very much.
But now, here is another question, though. Mm-hmm. Since they are putting into place safeguards for that kind of thing, isn't there a lesson to be learned from that?
Chair Carter, yes. In our information security office has been in contact with Providence to find out what they're doing to safeguard against this. So, and typically we ask our office to do that kind of outreach anytime there's an incident, so we can do a lessons learned from those types of things.
Exactly, because I think that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Because in our quest as human beings to bring about excellence, to bring about some of the workload that we have, and especially people who are parents and wanting to go home, I can see taking work home to try to make sure you're caught up and to apply the issue of excellence and making sure that you're not behind. I can see that.
Yeah.
But I can't see leaving it in the car. I mean, because you can't ever tell when that's a safe thing. But I think there is a lesson to be learned in terms of how they're handling that security issue.
Yeah.
And so that makes sense.
Chair Carter, absolutely. And we would certainly prefer to get those lessons learned from other people's experience rather than our own experience.
I applaud you for that.
Yes.
Okay,
thank you very, very much.
Go ahead.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, just I wanted to cover just a small piece. A comment was made by Senator Walker earlier that the problems that we experience is beyond systems. And I just want to acknowledge that as we talk about financial accountability, as we talk about budget issues that we face, one of the problems that we're seeing is people with the knowledge of the department are leaving or retiring. And that is causing us to face a significant challenge that we don't quite know how to address. You know, in our finance and policy analysis section, almost 70% of the staff are new. And, you know, in an organization of this size and complexity, when that kind of institutional knowledge leaves the organization, we are faced with a huge dilemma. The other problem that we face is, you know, earlier you asked, why would Mr. Kroll work for the state? Well, the extension of that question is, why would anybody would want to work for DHS? And really, why I ask that question is, if you have a $10 billion budget to manage, and you're basically compensated at the same level as if you're managing a $1 billion budget or $1 million budget, you know, what are some incentives for folks to stay in DHS and do this work? You talked about taking work home. I can't tell you how many people are working weekends and taking work home in DHS, because not only because of the complexity of the department, the workload, but frankly, the budget shortfall that we're facing right now is putting extra the stress on all of us. And, you know, in the midst of all this, we are trying to manage, and I think Mr. Todd can give you a better perspective about that, but those are the other challenges that goes beyond systems, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. And
I appreciate that, too. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Napoleon?
Thank you, Senator. Just a quick comment. In a previous life, being a caseworker in a local mental health center, I remember those who did their job and just did their job to whatever the minimum was and went home every night. And then my sense, though, from a lot of the staff in Oregon, you have people who are out there being not just creative, but also kind of going that extra yard to get people in the system, on the system, and again, above and beyond, just kind of doing that minimum. And that's just my perspective from kind of working with the legislature and with a lot of DHS people out there, that I think it's commendable.
Mr. Chair Carter, Mr. Berkovian, and I appreciate that comment. And just adding to my previous comment, we also do know, and, you know, we are also examples of that, money is not the first factor for people, you know, to continue to work in an organization. It, I think, on the list of priorities, it probably ranks fifth or sixth. There are other factors. But, you know, when you are facing other pressures, it can become a variable. And, you know, just, again, there are so many dedicated and staff in DHS who are here for the commitment to social service, as all of you know.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Carter, I'd like to ask Sarah Singer, who's the budget analyst with our Senior and People with Disabilities Cluster, and Robert O'Shea, who is the manager of our overpayment writing unit in our Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, to join me at the table, and they'll be sharing with you some of the challenges they face, similar to the information that Meg and Paul shared with you for their particular areas. Right. So,
welcome.
I turn it over to Sarah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Carter and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Singer, and I'm a senior fiscal analyst with the Seniors and People with Disabilities. My specific specialty is the developmentally disabled programs. And I'm here to talk a little bit about the challenges of our systems and what we have here. And I was glad that Sean Jacobson also mentioned the extensive use of Excel. Most everybody that I work with works with Excel. We're able to take information out of the Orbit system for budget. We dump it down into Excel. We manipulate it. We work with our programs. And we're taking things down to the lowest level with our program areas, down to a service level, like residential services, but how people came into the system, taking it down to that lowest level and then bringing it back up, rolling it back up into Orbitz. We take information out of the accounting system through GRIO reports, dumping it down into Excel. Again, taking it down to the lowest level, the reports that we're getting, are they making sense? Being able to tell what's being spent in different programs and rolling it back up. So when we get requests from legislators or pretty much anybody, we're having to look through Excel spreadsheets and trying to find that level of detail, because the information in the Orbitz is at such a high level, it's very difficult to tell anything from that high level of information. So that's pretty much where we have come from. One of the things that we're working on to help with this is we're reviewing the Forestry Center has a database that they're using right now to input their information into Orbitz, so it's more closely related, and trying to keep track of that so you're not relying on individual people's spreadsheets. So we're testing that out right now. So that's, thank you.
How many people work in your department to help to input data?
Chair Carter, there's about 50 analysts that work across the cluster. In my specific area, there's two analysts that work in developmental disabilities programs. There's another two that work specifically on the aged and physically disabled budget. And we have three other analysts that work on our administration, institutions, and some of our other aged and physically disabled programs. Further questions? Thank you.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert O'Shea. I'm the manager with the Overpayment Writing Unit, which operates within the agency's Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. I'll keep this presentation brief in the interest of time. But the primary mission of our unit is to identify and calculate time periods and dollar amounts of overpaid public assistance and food stamp benefits made to DHS clients, as well as overpayments made to child care providers with the agency. We're very highly involved in program integrity efforts and attempts to improve payment accuracy and recovery. As far as all of the interactions that we have with the various DHS systems, our staff are very involved in researching case records in a lot of these mainframe systems and client databases, as well as entering overpayment information into the overpayment system, which is on the mainframe, and other standalone databases. The overpayment system itself interfaces with many other mainframe systems, such as the food stamp management information system, as well as the client maintenance system. The program was developed back in the mid-1980s and does have a lot of challenges for us today. Some of those involve the lack of expandability of the system requires us to maintain several other standalone databases, which results in a lot of duplicate data entry, rekeying information into these multiple systems. As well, there are some other challenges because of this lack of expandability, including the inability of our overpayment recovery unit to calculate interest on outstanding overpayment balances, which results in lost revenue to the state. The age of the overpayment system has created problems with data linkage and in our ability to track medical overpayments and to track those separately from other public assistance overpayments.
How far do you go back?
The information on the system goes back years into the past.
So if you overpay a hospital and that, well, you're just talking about individual clients,
yeah.
Not
yes.
System of that nature. Okay, got you. Well, let's just take an individual client. And if you have overpaid them and you discover 2 years down the line that you've overpaid them, you go back and take their money from them even though they're still your client? Or do you give them opportunity? Clint, maybe you won't answer that. Or do you give them opportunity to pay it back a little bit at a time? Or do you take that out of that whole check?
Chair Carter, actually, I'll let Robert answer that. He knows.
Chair Carter, there are a number of different recovery methods put in place. Particularly if a client is still involved in public assistance or the food stamp program, recoveries of overpaid benefits can be accomplished through benefit reduction,
okay.
As well as wage garnishments, seizure of tax returns, things of that nature. Because of the delicate nature of a lot of DHS clients, of course, our recovery actions are not nearly as aggressive as recovery action could potentially be in the private sector.
Okay.
So those types of things are taken into consideration by the overpayment recovery unit.
Very good.
Other problems with the overpayment system result in incorrect billings being generated and also the lack of a common debtor database. The overpayment system is used primarily by the overpayment recovery unit and my unit, which is the overpayment writing unit. But there are other program integrity units, such as the state's administration, personal injury liens, medical payment recovery, that have their own standalone systems, standalone databases. Without this common debtor database, medical payment recovery or personal injury liens could be pursuing a recovery on their end. We could have a recovery that we are pursuing from an overpayment on our end, and we may not know that there are duplicate recovery efforts going on without a common debtor database, which we don't have at this point. Improved systems support for these program integrity efforts could certainly increase overpayment recovery, reduce the ratio of staff time spent versus amount of dollars recovered, and also improve the accuracy of billing, tracking, and crediting payments made on overpayments, as well as allowing for future expansion of cost avoidance and program integrity efforts and overpayment recovery activities. The ultimate end result is what we are striving to achieve is that more money is recovered and recycled back into the system to be made available for eligible DHS clients.
Questions? Good job. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Thanks, sir. Thanks. Chair Carter, that kind of wraps up the information technology part of the presentation, and unless there are any further questions, we are ready to move on to the caseload forecasting part
you,
of the presentation.
Do you, members of the committee, do you feel that your questions have been sufficiently answered, or is there anybody that you'd like to bring back to the podium at this point before we move to the next panel?
I think they did a very good
they
job.
They did an excellent job.
Thank you.
Very good. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
So moving on, Chair Carter and members of the committee, I'm going to ask Vic Todd, who is our assistant director for our Office of Finance and Policy Analysis, and Judy Moore Peterson, who is the manager of the Caseload Forecasting Unit, to join me at the table, and they'll be making the next part of the presentation.
Thank you.
Senator Carter, members of the committee, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I'm the manager for the Client Caseload Forecasting Unit. I'm going to be walking you through a little bit on high level on forecasting that we do within the department. This is a client caseload forecasting as opposed to budget or expenditure kind of forecasting. You should be receiving the handouts that go along with this presentation. So we couldn't send them out electronically because they are done in a software program that does Visio, and a lot of people don't have that. So we just brought the hard copies. Okay. What I'm going to be doing is walking you through the overall process, the roles and responsibilities in doing the caseload forecasting and the kind of tools that we use. And how we can use other kind of tools to be more timely and effective, outlining some of those gaps or resources that we've been able to identify that we think would enable us to provide a better context for the forecast that might allow policymakers, both within DHS as well as members of the legislature, to use the numbers more effectively. I do want to note, however, that it does not mean that the caseloads won't go up when in an unpredicted way, or that they won't go down in an unpredicted way. Those elements of it, we can only work on trying to do a better job of the predicting, but we don't actually control the direction of those caseloads. So first of all, the client caseload forecasting unit as a separate unit working on the forecasts has been in existence for just over about a year and a half now. Prior to that time period, each division would work on their own forecasts of the caseloads, and the standards and the methods that we use were quite variable in how that was accomplished. At the present time, within our centralized unit, we forecast three main areas. We forecast the Office of Medical Assistance Programs caseloads, the long-term care aged and physically disabled caseloads, as well as the children, adults, and families caseloads, which is made up of food stamps, TANF, child welfare, vocational rehabilitation. Those are the main areas. There's about seven main groups, and they make up 45 different subpopulations. In addition, we're working on adding to that an additional 12 sort of subpopulations in the mental health, development disabilities, and the alcohol and drug area. Forecasts are done. Up to this point, they're done twice a year, every 6 months. We also do some monthly tracking. That monthly tracking is increasing who that goes to, the level of detail, et cetera, is increasing now. So in general, we use the historical trends within the data that's available to us to estimate what the future is going to be for these particular client estimates.
One question.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me then if I'm hearing myriads of people engaged in this process. And I hear that you forecast twice a year, every 6 months. What do you need? What would you need in your arsenal of tools to be able to forecast more often so that, and please, this is not taking a pot shot at you at all. How could we have known that we were even $50 million in a hole as opposed to $172 million? How could we have known that? In terms of what you guys do as forecasters, this is not meant to be...
Right. No. Senator Carter, I think that that is a combination of both the connection between the forecast and then the budget side of it, in that the forecast is done, and we do the monthly tracking, but tying that back to the changes over time and the cost per case, those kinds of tools, making a stronger connection there and having that data more readily available would likely assist the agency and the legislators in being able to see it coming sooner.
So,
but I think that my supervisor, Victor, would have a little to say about that.
I'll wait. So,
okay.
He's used to us taking pot shots at him.
Chair Carter, Vic Todd, Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. The issue that I think that we're dealing with is, well, there are many facets to it, one of which is that this is a young group from the standpoint of maturity. We've put in place a pretty robust process in terms of who's involved, who is doing external review, and we're expanding that, and Judy's going to talk about that a little bit. I think probably the major key issue for us is that what they're really doing is forecasting policy impacts and the cross implications of many policy decisions. And the piece that's even outside of that are all the demographic issues, what's the economy doing, and how does that influence then what it was that you thought those policy decisions were going to cause to happen. And so there's multiple layers of complexity to this that at this point I think we've really just begun to build the foundation around building a strong objective process. And we're still needing to build those other pieces around, well, but the demographics say this, so why aren't you seeing this population decline or go up? And there are other factors that are causing some influence that we don't yet understand.
Okay.
And so that's a piece that we're working on trying to define how would we develop that.
I'm going to ask a question that's going to sound very simplistic, but I know it's not a simple question. And that question... would be then how does budget turn some of the policies that we make into actual dollars, since these people are evaluating the policies?
Mm-hmm.
At what point in this system between forecasting and budget do we actually turn these into dollars?
Chair Carter, once the forecast is completed, the budget staff then take those forecasts and start with a basic approach to estimating that cost in terms of whatever the change in the population is that's forecast. They'll take the existing parameters and say this will be the impact as a result of that. They then take that information and supplement it with any other additional information that they may know at the time, change in what the expected cost per was for a particular client group, federal policy change that may have an influence, those sorts of factors. So it goes through a pretty involved process once the forecast is done. That really entails a different type of forecasting around budgetary needs. That's helpful.
Okay. If you could take out the diagram or the figure that says at the top, caseload forecast roles and responsibilities, I'd just like to walk you very quickly an overview of the
groups of people who are involved at the present time in the KISA forecast process. First of all, to start off in the middle column where it says unit group, the first box there says the caseload forecasting unit. That's the unit that I manage. We have three main forecasters, and as I mentioned before, they're forecasting all of those major DHS programs. And I do want to point out that we don't, at the present time, we don't forecast all of the client caseloads. There's some smaller ones, actually some larger ones dollar-wise that we still haven't been able to bring in yet, and we're kind of stretched at the limit as to what we can do with the staff that we have available. We also have four research analysts. Part of their job is to check on what Vic was mentioning, like the demographic factors or the economic factors, seeing if we can learn about how they might influence DHS caseloads or tracking epidemics or a whole variety of things that they try to research and follow up on. I will get to the integrated client data warehouse program manager in a moment, and then we also have someone to help us with the program, the publication.
Yes. Question, just so I understand, this group is looking at external and internal assumptions or things that are out there that may have some implications on case outcomes. It doesn't necessarily mean the number of clients that are in, but could be an epidemic over here that's happening somewhere. Is that what this group does?
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, we look at those factors, but at this point, a lot of it is more exploratory, and that we have not been able to come up with a method yet to incorporate it into the mathematical models in predicting the caseloads. We would use it more as an indication, this is going to be a risk to the upcoming caseload, in that we can predict that it's likely that additional people will be coming on the caseload or perhaps going off the caseload, but the magnitude, the duration, the number, how many precise people may be coming on or off the caseload is kind of beyond our capabilities at the present time.
Even though you can't be precise, look at those assumptions or those factors or those particularly external ones that may have an implication on your forecasting.
Senator Carter and Senator Winters, yes, we do try to look at those factors. Again, their exact influence, how they may play out in the future, oftentimes is really up for a great deal of discussion and debate. I think a classic example of that is actually the increasing the demographics in the for the elderly population and their demand for long-term care services. There's a great deal of discussion that's going on at the present time regarding what is going to lead to, are there going to be increased caseloads within the long-term care? And I think the answer is probably yes, but at what point, what's the demand, and how will the state sort of address that is certainly up for discussion and debate. Other factors that go into that besides just that there's an aging demographics, so also the health of that population, which will determine when they may start or when they may go into long-term care, how long they live, what kind of resources are available to them, as well as the capacity, the market itself. Are there placements in what kinds of long-term care settings available? All of that plays a role in looking at the impact on the overall caseloads. And we do think about that and try to discuss that and discuss what some of the implications are for our particular forecast. Again, we don't have the tools to be able to say precisely, well, in this, you know, in 1 year time, in month, you know, January of 2008, there's going to be this many people who are going to be in the adult foster care system. That level of precision isn't available.
Even within a range of, and I don't think that in any forecasting are you looking for precise figures. We know that there is always a range. We don't get a precise number when we do the revenue forecasting. I mean, that's sometimes come within a range. But where you have, like example, you mentioned the long-term care system, and we know that the baby boomers coming of age. We know that, for example, there's an increase in individuals moving into Oregon, but based on looking at the statistics that we get from motor vehicles, we know certain factors and we know certain percentages. Does that help in the discussion of what can be anticipated so that you can plan ahead?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, that is precisely what we are trying to do. In order to do that more effectively, more comprehensively, it takes staff time and it takes resources. And that is, to do that well is beyond our staff capabilities at the present time. Just in the sheer amount of time that would be needed to go into that. I brought up an example of one area that we started to work on, but there's a lot more work that we foresee could be done and would be very useful for long-term and long-range planning. I do want to point out just very briefly that in this world of caseload forecasting, we actually do produce a precise number that then the budget analysts use to help build the budget. So there is an actual number that is produced that, you know, 2 years from now that says how many people will be in that particular setting.
Are there other agencies that are doing forecasting? State agencies?
Department of Corrections.
Does.
Oregon Youth Authority. But they're all done, by DAS.
Right.
What about the employment division?
Don't know.
Maybe they don't. But I'm just looking at who does. Senator Devlin.
I'm trying to get sort of a clear view of what you can predict and what you can't predict.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at this graph that you indicated. And would an example be of what you can kind of say that might have an impact but you really can't predict? Let's look at spring summer 2004 active outreach by advocates prior to closure of OHP standard. You anticipate that that would have an increase, or you could have anticipated that that would have an increase in utilization of programs, but you don't. But that may be one where you could just say that you're unsure about where your data is going to go because you don't really have a history with this. You don't know how well the outreach effort's going to be. You don't. But how about if we had something that was more just straightforward? You have a larger number of people unemployed. You know that unemployment benefits are only going to last for so long. You know that certain people are going to be cut off of unemployment benefits. In many cases, those unemployment benefits might have been high enough so that they would not have qualified for food stamps, etc. But you know that at a certain point, certain people are going to be will no longer have benefits. Would you be able to predict what impact that would have on your caseload?
Chair Carter, Senator Devlin, even in my short experience with it, doing this particular position, even the most what seemingly straightforward thing that one can forecast has proven to be much more complicated than one would on the surface think. And that particular example, again, while you might be able to estimate that there's going to be a certain proportion of people who are going to have their unemployment benefits drop off, that the difficulty there is I can probably look at that and say, okay, here's the population, and we might have a guesstimate on how many of those are going to walk into one of our offices and fill out the application for a benefit. But what I'm going to be unable to predict is, one, how many are going to do that, and also what services, what additional services other than food stamps are they going to qualify for? If the whole family is applying, I don't know how many additional people are going to be on that case. And so it's a little more complicated than just looking at those unemployment figures. We can say, yes, that we think that this population may be rolling in or affecting overall the overall population of people seeking DHS services, but to give the preciseness of it, the magnitude, the length of time, what exact services they would qualify for, is much more complicated. Let me just take you to a different graph. If you turn to the caseload forecast process, and there's the second two boxes. They say one on the left hand side it says collect the forecast data, on the other side it says collect other relevant information. I want to point out what we've been talking about is essentially the right-hand box over here. And that has to do with policy changes, changes in the economy, changes in the demographics, et cetera. And for a large part, those provide the overall context in which people are seeking DHS services. The complicated part of it, again, is evaluating the overall magnitude and the effect and that getting that level of preciseness. At the present time, our primary focus has actually not been as much on the right-hand side and looking at those overall factors, because we found that most of the variance, most of the things that cause sort of the ups and downs has to do more with policy changes and DHS business practices. And so we've primarily focused our efforts up to this point on doing a better job at using our historical data to predict the future. This is the next area on the right-hand side where we see the value, the additional value that's necessary to provide better information for DHS policymakers and legislators in determining for the long-range planning on how many people are going to be seeking DHS services.
Madam Chair, is there more of an implicit indication in your comment there that to some degree the more stable and consistent in terms of changes in DH policies, in terms of changes of eligibility, the more clear it will be possible to forecast?
Chair Carter and Senator Devlin, thanks. Okay, that's always the case.
Chair Carter, Senator Devlin.
I think dreamers.
That is a key issue, though, that I think that what the department has experienced in the last 4 or 5 years with all the programmatic changes and policy shifts, that it has weakened the utility of using a historic model as a basis to project forward. And so we are looking at other methodologies, outside of that kind of core process. But you immediately get into a situation of who's going to predict those other elements into the future. That as you go outside and pick up, say, for example, the unemployment and its impact on all the different program areas, who is then doing the projection of future employment or unemployment that you can use as part of your forecast? So it continually there's just different levels of complexity that you add to this as you try to find new methodologies.
So in some ways your role seems like one of forecasting, but in another sense it's like one of reconnaissance.
This is not a science.
Can I use an example of something I don't understand the full implications of it? Because I've heard of people that have gone through the process of trying to qualify for other programs just to get their prescriptions covered. And some of those people will now be eligible under the Medicare Part D. Do we have any idea what the impact of that might be in terms of certain caseloads? Have we even looked at that?
Chair Carter, Senator Devlin, we indeed have looked at or tried to look at what we thought the impact of the Medicare Modernization Act would be on our caseloads. It actually has a dual impact in both because, as you pointed out, fewer people may be seeking medical assistance or health insurance coverage because the only reason that they were coming through our doors is because they were looking to get their prescription drugs covered. However, there were a lot of outreach efforts, particularly to the low-income individuals within our state, in which it was sent out and said that you may qualify for low-income subsidies for the Medicare Part D. And that we felt would also or could lead to an increase in our caseloads as a larger pool of people, low-income people, may qualify for DHS services as they sought that low-income subsidy.
Thank you, Chair. And this is something I pulled from what I thought was a very good analysis by LFO in January that I'm wondering, I think they point out that normally when you see an increase in the economy, a better job rate, we'd say less people on TANF, but yet we saw an uptick, which kind of points to the fact that maybe this economic upturn wasn't what normally happens. Are we seeing more and more of those kind of external changes where normally the model that we thought would work to change our case, though it isn't really, fleshing out like we think it would? I mean, does this require you to kind of think in a different way, I guess, and a lot of different external factors that influence the caseload, not just the economy? I mean, you mentioned aging. Are there issues out there?
Well, Chair Carter and Mr. Bacobian, there are so many different factors that influence and interplay in affecting the DHS caseloads. That's one example where because it the sort of common wisdom was that if you had an improving economy, that would lead to a decrease in the TANF caseloads. I do want to point out that this particular TANF caseload is what you're referring to are those individuals who meet the TANF criteria, but they may or may not be on the TANF cash grant. They may not be receiving the cash sort of side of that, and they may be only receiving the medical assistance, or in other words, the Oregon Health Plan side of that. And what we found with that particular caseload is that it wasn't just the economy. There's a number of other factors having to do with the availability of health insurance, and then the rise in the TANF caseloads also coincided with some of the cuts and the changes that were occurring on the Oregon Health Plan. So it also had to do with how some of those changes in policy and how some of those cuts interacted and played out in the other caseloads on the Oregon Health Plan. And so that sort of complexity is oftentimes difficult to predict, and oftentimes actually is difficult to figure out, even looking back in time and trying to figure out, well, this had this impact, this had this impact, et cetera, and you know, how much had the impact on each one of those elements is very complicated. As I think you mentioned, that forecasting is both an art and a science, and so it's both the mathematical models, et cetera, as well as that art of, well, we think it's going to have this impact, and trying to figure those things out given the data and the information that's available to us.
Chair Carter, I think one other key piece to this also is Judy at one point said, well, we give a precise number to budget staff. And Senator Winters had made a comment that I was wanting to respond to because she talked about a range. Mm-hmm. That while on the economic forecast they produce a number, there's also a range. And I think that's one of the traps that we get in is that for a budget purpose, we have to identify a point and say this is what the average caseload will be. And that pretty much ties everyone's hands around the fact that, well, you said this would be the number, when in fact it really is a range, and a decision's been made from a risk standpoint that this is the most likely outcome. It doesn't mean that it is that is the line you're going to be on with right. these caseloads. And I think that's a key element in all of this discussion in terms of why is it above or below what you forecast. It's the reality is that it is a range, and people are based upon all of this discussion saying this is the most appropriate line for budget purposes. And I think that's a...
Is the system center then, I guess, kind of like where we're kind of intuitive, where then you know, we've seen this kind of anomaly, I guess, of some sort where there's maybe these factors of interact and they haven't quite forecast, that years down the line now we can, again, look at that again and kind of keep that factored in, that we've learned something that it doesn't always kind of flesh out like we think it will. Based on historical data, then we get the system. I mean, is the model, the mathematics we're set up to do that, or is it still going to be a good mode of guesstimation somewhere?
Well, Chair Carter, Mr. Ricardo, there's always a good deal of guesstimation. We're just trying to reduce that amount and keep adding and accumulating the information. And the mathematical models, depending on which one you use, of which there's literally hundreds, will take into account that those kind of fluctuations and to whether it's a one-time change, like a data anomaly in which you don't want to repeat that in your future because it was a one-time shift, right? And you're thinking to yourself, this isn't going to happen again. So you don't want to repeat that. But when it becomes a pattern, then the trick is, okay, you do want to repeat this pattern and on an ongoing basis. And so that's actually both that's an example of a mix between, is this a one-time change, or is this is this going to repeat itself over and over again?
Mm-hmm. Senator Devlin?
Is someone trying to look at data on this side and just trying to see where things are going? I mean, when I look at, to the degree I do, at DH caseload, commonly what I'm presented with is, you know, number of clients in each program. I might get number of clients in each county. I might get a little bit more data than that. But is the data available to, like, tell us, for instance, the number of 10 of clients? How many of them are long-term clients versus shorter-term clients? How many of them are reoccurring clients? In terms of the Oregon Health Plan, while we set certain levels in terms of federal poverty level, common comment we hear is that many of the people, even though the poverty level might be set at this level, there's a very large percentage that might only be at 10% of the poverty level or 15% of the poverty level. Is that data readily available? I mean, so you get some greater understanding of the issues that you're dealing with. Because commonly all I see is just numbers, just a few numbers in terms of number of clients and which counties they're in. And
Chair Carter, Senator Devlin, it's actually the answer to that is a yes and a no. Some of it is more available than other pieces of that information.
That data sounds like the Bush administration.
Not exactly sure how to take that one. If you look at the diagrams that have that says at the top is a bunch of circles with more circles, and it says at the top source systems used for forecasting. At the present time, that there actually shouldn't be the arrows heading to the middle box, because each system is independent. And that's the data that comes in and feeds into doing that particular forecast. Within that, you can take a look at how long individuals who were, for example, in vocational rehabilitation were in that system, right? So you can do an evaluation of that and see how many clients are cycling back in, et cetera. And that data is part or used as part of the the forecasting process. But you, if you note, they're kind of, they are independent systems. And some of them, you'll see that it's multiple data systems that are feeding a single forecast. And when you see that, then that's very, very, that adds to the complexity, and it's more difficult to be able to do that kind of analysis of how long people have stayed in, how long the TANF people have been there, etc. If you want to turn that, I don't know if it's a separate one or if you turn it over, but there's another diagram that says integrated client services. We are in the process of building a data warehouse that will enable our unit, as well as the department, to analyze or to pull together all the clients who receive the services into one data warehouse. That will enable us to see the interconnectedness of our clients, and it will help us be able to model some of those policy suggestions, those policy changes in a way that we are literally unable to do at the present time. So, for example, if you make a change in the child welfare system, or maybe that's not a good example, in the Oregon Health Plan, at the present time, you don't necessarily know what other kinds of services those individuals are receiving at other points in the department. And so you can't see necessarily what those interactions would be, or another way to think of it, the hydraulic effects. You know, if you affect it over here, you don't know if that's going to push up caseloads elsewhere. And we're cautiously optimistic that this tool will help us do that and be able to also see how long they stay, where the common sort of entry points are into the department, maybe patterns of care. You know, as a client might start here, they have this set of services. What other kind of services do they commonly receive? And perhaps we can also take a look at the kinds of services that might be more effective, that, you know, if you provide these sets of services, we see fewer people coming back onto the DHS caseloads. That's our hope, and we are in the process of trying to build that. Our time frames are to have that project beginning test in June and July of this year. So we'll... It's a very large project, so we're keeping our fingers crossed here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions, and one I'm going to ask as I was coming back in. Senator Winters asked me to ask a question that she had forgotten to ask. So she wanted to know what's the average length of service in long-term care, if you can tell us that.
Chair Carter, Senator Walker, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but we can certainly bring those back to the committee.
Okay, great. And then I'll ask my question, if okay. I might. And you might have discussed it as I've been going in and out. I've had an issue come up today that has taken me out of the room. But one of the things that I talked about earlier today was how policy, new policies at the state and the federal level make its way to the forecasting unit. And you've talked about TANF, and let's use that as an example, because it's my understanding the department was not aware that there was an extended TANF provision that allowed people to be on TANF an extra year. I learned that the department was not aware of that and did not include it in its forecasting. My information could be wrong. But let's use that as an example, then. How do you know when there's changes in federal or state law that will impact your ability to forecast accurately?
Chair Carter, Senator Walker, the department and the forecasting unit is actually well aware of the TANF extended and the transitional benefits that people receive, and it has been included in the Oregon Health Plan forecast. I believe perhaps where that confusion may have come up is that we didn't break it out in two forecasts ago. We had been broken up, and then they thought, well, no, we'll combine those two for a series of reasons that I can't recall right now, but in the last two forecasts, it was again broken out because they do have different patterns of change over time.
Okay. So then how did you learn about that change?
Right. That how we learn about changes in policy, et cetera, is mixed, how we do that. If you look at the...
Did I miss this? I'm sorry.
No,
you haven't gone
okay.
over this yet?
No, I haven't gone over it.
I really hate to be out of the room and have you go over it and then come in and ask again.
So if you look at the Casewood forecast process that has the beginning, that has the box that says begin, part of what we do is we have a group of people together that meet on each of the program areas that we forecast called a steering committee. And in that steering committee, it's made up of not just my team, but also the program managers, experts in DHS on those particular programs. It's made up of, there's also an LFO analyst and a BAM analyst to attend those as well. And some of explicitly we ask during those meetings, are you aware of any upcoming policy changes? Have you made any policy changes? Have there been any changes at the federal level that you either anticipated or have occurred? So that's when we're in the middle of doing the actual forecast, we explicitly ask the people who would know whether there's changes, and we try to invite those people who are the experts in those areas to those meetings to ensure that we do get that information. That process can be improved in that sometimes there have been changes which people have not anticipated would make a caseload, have a caseload impact. And when that happens, then, you know, you only learn about it sort of after the fact, mm-hmm. and that you're going, boy, something seemed to have happened here. You know, we're noticing that mm-hmm. a particular group is going up or it's dropping faster than what we might have anticipated. And so you start to ask questions, and that comes up during the monthly tracking that is done. You ask questions. It seems to be, the caseload seems to be going in a direction that we weren't anticipating. Is there something that's going on that you're thinking about that might have that impact? Then additional work or research needs to be done to see whether that does pan out, whether it's sometimes we might think that's the case, but when you drill down, you go, if that was the case, then you would expect the numbers to change in this way. So you have to keep digging until you can kind of figure that out. But it is oftentimes fairly complicated and almost never as straightforward as one might think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Devlin?
I wanted to use an example of that from a recent meeting because, I mean, everyone that's there is probably far more aware of all these changes than I am. And I went to a recent meeting where they were explaining some of the things that were thrown into the Budget Reconciliation Act at the federal level. And one of them, I believe, was, I don't know if I'm using the proper terminology, was basically for TANF clients, moving them from TANF to work and the sort of what sort of baseline data you would use. And they were talking about moving from where our status was in 95 as sort of our... to where our status is in 2005. And they were saying it would require, we were one of the states that had an incredible number. It said that we would require about a 485.4% improvement in effort. but it also said that they didn't know exactly how the requirement in the Reconciliation Act would be determined in federal regulation, and that was months away from determination. Mm-hmm. It did not know to what degree states would be given more time to comply mm-hmm. with it, but it was just like sort of, I went to this presentation on the Reconciliation Act, which basically said all the things that they stuck into it at the last moment, because you could put it in the Reconciliation Act and just pass it with 51 votes, and you can't, you know, you don't need 60 votes for closure. So a lot of the things that they can never do before, they threw into this act, and that was one of them. But I think that you must have a lot of examples like that where a change occurs in federal legislation,
it might take, to my guess, it might even take a year or more mm-hmm. before you see a federal regulation.
Right.
And you don't really know how much latitude they're going to give you, or maybe whether or not they're going to even increase it beyond the level of what you thought that the statute would do.
Chair Carter, Senator Dublin, that is correct. There are many examples like that.
Yeah.
Chair Carter and Senator Dublin, that is a key piece, and that was a comment I was going to make to Senator Walker, because not only do you have the action occur, and then there's a year or so before the federal rule is put in place, most often it's retroactive. And so while you've continued your policy that the legislature put in place,
yes.
You then get to a place where you've done these caseload forecasts or program forecasts, and suddenly you come in and say, well, there was a change that's retroactive. And you can get into a discussion of, well, how did you not know that? and it's this whole process that the federal government works on a time frame that's different. And those rulemaking processes often, you know, run forward and then go backwards to a point in time, and that does create problems for us.
Just I'd like to add one other comment, and that oftentimes the policies that come up, how exactly they're going to be implemented, or how it's going to kind of be implemented in a particular state or a particular program. Oftentimes, there's a lot of questions because they, you know, the rules, et cetera, aren't as clear as you might hope for, and so there oftentimes, you know, you're left mm-hmm. trying to figure out how to implement something when there's a lot of questions on what was the intent, and the fine print of it isn't very clear.
I hate to be so redundant, but tell me, and I know that there are varying degrees of any kind of anything that is made from an assumption, there are varying degrees of what happens to that assumption. I want to know, how is it that we can be so far off in terms of our forecasting at that we were this last time around? What allows that to happen? What didn't we know that allowed that to happen?
My child.
Let me tell you the reason I'm asking you this.
Mm-hmm.
At one time in the state, corrections used to do their own forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that maybe they were too close to the issues to mm-hmm. forecast. Not that maybe there was not a mathematical model along with the art of being able to make some assumptions to bring about good forecasting. But let's have a group of economists outside of this. I'm one of the people that have said maybe we should take forecasting out of the department
mm-hmm.
and make it a separate entity like we did with corrections. That's why I'm asking this question.
Mm-hmm.
So that if people like me follow through on this and it comes to fruition, then the question becomes, are we any better off because it's outside of the department, or do we have the same kind of tools in place on the inside that we need, but it's just that forecasting is both an art and a science?
Mm-hmm. Chair Carter, I think that's probably the toughest question of the day, but we've looked at that issue in terms of, you know, would it make more sense for it to be outside of the department? And I think what we, in putting this unit in place, what we did was to draw that responsibility out of the rest of the department and create an entity that's independent of the program clusters. And to do just what you were suggesting, that is to remove it, but to have an objective process. And what we've really come to understand is that need to have the program connection, but have the objectivity. In some ways, it's similar to the role that BAM plays with respect to, you know, standing away from the agencies and doing an independent assessment of what it is that they're identifying as their needs. And so we've had lots of conversations with various forecasting groups, including our external review group. And the connection that we need to have, I think, is really more to how do we connect these forecasts with all of that other demographic piece and begin to identify what are the longer-term implications for the impact that demographic would have on existing policy, so we can then look at it from the standpoint of how do we change policy to get to, you know, the client-level outcome we want. And so I'm not sure if I'm fully answering your question, but I think that's how we've really arrived at, and in discussions with DAS have concluded that it does make more sense to leave it, you know, as an intact entity within DHS and have all of this external review process around it to ensure it maintains that objectivity. But I think when it's all said and done, it is an art and a science. And the art part is where you get to that variability.
Chair Carter, we did have discussions with DAS, and this was definitely an option we considered. And I think after having those discussions, the decision was made between the new director in DAS, Mr. Ball, and Dr. Goldberg, that for now it seemed to make more sense to leave it there, not because they both recognize the importance of the connection to the program. However, what we also agreed to is that DAS would assist us in kind of doing a third-party review of the forecasts and could kind of be that objective look and ask questions that needed to be asked and just kind of be another checkpoint on are our assumptions sound, are we making good assumptions, did we miss anything, and that's kind of where we landed on this issue. The other piece of it is that we are really trying to focus, because one of the limiting factors on accuracy of forecasts is the data, the timeliness and the accuracy. And so one of the things that we also have as a priority is working and trying to set up this data warehouse to increase accuracy as well as the timeliness of the data.
Yes. Oh, just one more. We'll each take a turn here. One more piece of that is that you asked what happened, what went wrong, mm-hmm. And we are in the process of trying to evaluate, are there things that we could do within the tools that we use, literally the mathematical models, mm-hmm. and how we choose to use them, that we could do differently that would reduce the variation. And so we've engaged with other states who do forecasting. We have also contacted the folks in DAS who do that forecasting to talk with them. There was the team from the Department of Administrative Services that came out and looked at the forecast, and we walked through our methods with them, and they have some suggestions. And we are very open to reviewing those, testing, piloting. Again, those take time, and they take resources to be able to try out new ways of doing things and seeing if they work or not. The one thing I do want to add, though, is whenever you go through a period of very, very rapid change, every forecast, no matter where it's done or who does it, is going to be challenged in being able to predict what those outcomes are going to be. And we as a state and as a department have undergone very rapid change in the last two to three years, more so than at any other time. And that change makes it extremely difficult to predict, within a certain range, what's going to occur in the future. And so we are trying to improve our tools, improve our methods, et cetera. But in the end, it is both an art and a science.
How do you give that data to the administrators, to your administrators in the department, in the sense that when there are policy changes that will greatly affect the assumptions you have already made within a given period of time, to send that message to the legislature that the policies of the federal government and the policies that you, legislature, put into place is going to change the bottom line assumptions that we have in place for the amount of dollars that you're going to spend. I don't think anybody is second-guessing your work in terms of mathematical and artistic models that you're using to do this, but somewhere along the line, you and Dr. Goldberg need to have that information come from them so you can give it to the Legislative Assembly
sure.
to know that you have something coming that we can't even guesstimate or put through mathematical means and come up with how much it's going to cost you,
sure. mm-hmm.
i.e. the Oregon Health Plan.
Mm-hmm.
When we took the standard people off, and then all of a sudden they could come in through another door, which took the cost right back up from where you thought you were bringing down costs. Not only have you affected the legislature, but it makes us look bad with the Tom Holtz of the world, who have said, legislature, these are the amount of dollars that you have contracted to work with me in terms of giving medication to a client. And then they're going to be catching hell from their clients, which means if they want to come back to you, and then our constituents want to come back. Somewhere along the line,
sure.
the communication process should be
yeah.
different, and we should be held accountable when we make changes in policies that make you change your mathematical model.
Well, Chair Carter, first of all, I think it's a big mistake for us to come to you every 6 months to report on caseload forecasting. That's not nearly enough. I mean, we have to be engaging you in an ongoing discussion
right.
about that. I'm not sure if you're aware that Dr. Goldberg actually has set up a committee, Representative Avorkian,
yeah.
Senator Winters, Representative Richardson,
right.
and Senator Lori Montes Anderson.
Great.
And they're meeting monthly.
Good.
Is that correct? To really kind of...
We've met once, and we'll meet again March
15th. Right. To really kind of... keep the legislative body to some extent more engaged, more informed, give them more up-to-date information, and also to give them a better understanding of some of the challenges we face and also the factors that are going to be impacting caseload. And these four people were appointed by the leadership
Great.
Of their respective caucuses, because we just it's just an issue for the department where we can't keep doing the business the way we've been doing it and expect a different result.
That's
we have to do things differently. We have to look at doing things differently and engaging this body in more frequent discussions and working with you a lot closer in explaining what the impacts are and potential factors, I think is something we need to keep doing.
That's great. Senator Devlin?
I want to ask a loaded question, Madam
Uh-oh.
Chair.
Get ready. Put your seatbelts on, because he's about to ask you a loaded question.
Chair Carter, Judy will be answering this question.
Right now, part of our issues and part of our difficulties is we are trying to forecast out for sometimes even a longer period than 2 years. If you haven't already started giving numbers, you will soon start giving numbers to DAS and to the governor's mm-hmm. office in terms of trying to put together a proposed governor's budget for the post 2007 biennium. People will want a certain high degree of certainty on what those numbers
mm-hmm.
are.
Mm-hmm.
You will give the governor probably numbers sometime in the fall that you believe are reasonably certain, so that the final budget can be prepared by the time the legislature meets in January. What if you were in a different system where we maybe still did a 2-year budget, but where we came back and reviewed the budget on a yearly basis, so that the certainty that you needed was about a year's time instead of 2 years plus?
Do you want me to answer that?
I'll try this.
No, actually,
yeah.
I think that's a good question.
No, I think it's a very good question,
uh-huh.
and hopefully I'll answer it. I'll answer this in a way that I will have an opportunity to meet with you in the future. But Chair Carter and Senator Devlin,
One of the things Dr. Goldberg tells people is that I can tell you with probably a high degree of accuracy what the caseload is going to be a month from now, and probably a fairly high degree of accuracy what it's going to be 2 months from now. The longer you push that out, the more difficult or the more in question the accuracy of that prediction will be. So the way I would answer your question is that more frequent review of the caseload in relation to budget, it just kind of, I think, closes that gap and potentially would increase the accuracy because you have more frequent review and you're not looking for the longer I think you look try to look forward and predict, the more in question the accuracy of that prediction would be. And I don't know, Vic, if you want to add.
Chair Carter, Senator Devlin, some of that issue is simply the amount of federal policy change that can occur in that window.
Right.
So, you know, while we're doing a review every 6 months, and that's really been historically premised on the fact that we rebalance every 6 months, that's a useful approach. But the confidence interval gets wider the farther out you go. So, yeah, if we're forecasting tomorrow, we have a little bit better luck than, you know, three years from now.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to get this on the record because I think it's probably time the state quit determining how often the legislature meets based on the number of days it took to ride a horse to Salem.
Okay, Richard. Do you have any questions, Mr. Coleman?
If I could, just maybe a two-part question. Looking at this chart here, it looks the kind of the roller coaster-looking change in population. And I'm wondering if it'd be interesting to see in the 90s if the line was a little more of a steady trajectory of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And is it possibly a correlation? I know we can't control this all the time. Forecasting when you see a rather steady trajectory in, say, in a population, then and you might have answered this question already, Judy, then we start seeing these kind of dips and valleys and spikes, how much of an impact does that have in trying to do a good forecast? In the past, say in the 90s, did we see similar issues with forecasting glitches that we're seeing now? Does this happen every so often? Or?
Are you going to do that?
Yeah.
Chair Carter, Mr. Rokobian, when you have fewer changes over time and you have a steady kind of trend, it's really easy to do your predictions. And so when you do have that roller coaster, it is much more difficult. I don't actually know whether there were a lot of changes in the 90s or, you know, before the advent of the Oregon Health Plan. Some of that data may not be available, but I do know that Dr. Goldberg has a chart that the folks tracking, I don't know if it's the TANF program or the food stamp program, they've been tracking policy changes back, you know, a long time, and you can see where whenever there's a change in those policies, and they do come relatively frequently in those programs at least, then you have a lot of change in the number of people coming in. Compared to the forecast, I don't know how they did.
Other question?
No.
This has been a great oversight day for us, and I thank you very much for clarifying more to me and setting more of an opportunity to see how much of science this is not. And also, I think want to just a little comment to you, and that is that I think one of the greatest things that I've learned out of this today is we need to have better communication between the department and the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to report more frequently on the status of the department in terms of policy changes and how it changes the baseline assumptions for the assumptions that you've made based upon what you 6 months to a year's time, and any time we bring other policies in the federal government, give other policies, it's going to change your bottom line assumptions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think communications is going to be the best way for this to happen. And even at our very best, we're going to be taking some risks. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people are looking for exactness, but I just think that when you go too far off, people get excited, very much so. And it creates the kind of problems in the media that we as legislators get a little upset about, and then we start looking for the science of it all with you. And you're telling us as much and as great as we possibly can that it's not a total science. And so I just think that that's information we have to communicate. And where we see things go wrong the most when it comes to our children. And so we're going to expect greater things from you on that in terms of those kind of issues. But other than that, like I said, when we first had our first committee hearing, my role and my expectations for this committee is that we'd work as partners and not as what are the Saturday night free-for-all wrestling matches where everybody out of the ring, you know. And so I think as long as we can do that we're going to make better partners when we are communicated to with a level of confidence that the direction which you're going is as scientific as you possibly can. For our next week, Mr. Bacobian? Okay. Was there, Clyde, anything else that you want to add to this? We did have a few minutes and said we'd be out at 12:30. In the event you might have something else you wanted to present that we did not do today.
No. Chair Carter, unless you or Senator Devlin or Mr. Bacobian have any questions, I think we've covered the ground quite thoroughly.
Questions? I hope not, Ms. Devlin.
I'll withhold the question until the next meeting.
No, Richard, please go on.
Could you give me just a list of which publications you actually produce in terms of forecasting?
We'll get that for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
A great day.
Thank you, Senator.
Now join.